war is a game that's gone too far, you know.
It's just like we've all just woken up one morning and thought, is it a dream? Is it a nightmare? What's been going on? And we're all just trying to make the next day a bit better.
We specifically did the poster event around the world for Christmas to try and get at least one plug-in for peace on earth at Christmas, because that's what it's about. And happy birthday, Christ, you know, is what it's about.
If you had one wish for Christmas time, what would it be?
Peace.
Peace on earth.
Yeah. And love.
Peace on earth. That implies no violence, no starving children, no violent minds, no violent households, no violence,
frustration.
No frustration, no fear.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not BCFM Politics Show. If you've been listening on the PRSC stream from 3 o'clock today, you should have been hearing the Richie Allen Show. He does his regular Friday show now, right here every week. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news is good old Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Supposed to have been joining us were a couple of people from Stand Up Bristol, Nate Turner and Harley Ford. Nate can't come. He's under orders, a family business, and also Harley Ford has literally this afternoon been ordered out of Bristol by the police, bailed to Northern Ireland, and he's on the train. Hopefully we'll be speaking to him on the way to Northern Ireland by phone. A bit of hair-raising live radio for you folks, as Harley, hopefully we won't be speaking to him in the middle of a tunnel or anything like that. But anyway, both of those two have been arrested, and Harley again arrested this afternoon during the Halloween lockdown for alleged COVID crimes, both connected with the Stand Up Bristol group. Anyway, in the second part, we'll have our usual roundup of world news, but also another little excerpt from the dawn of the Dajjalic New World Order. Well, the Dajjal is the Muslim's name for the Antichrist. It's a figure on the world stage, causing all sorts of trouble for humanity in the future, according to the Quran. And that was the title of an eschatology seminar I took part in a fortnight ago, organised by the Muslim think tank, bringing together Christians and Muslims, Global Vision 2000, to examine this time the plandemic and comparing it to some of the prophecies in the Bible and the Quran about the end of the world. As of tonight, you'll be hearing, hopefully, more of my longer interviews, ones we haven't had time to broadcast on this stream in between the recordings of the politics show. So my three books are published in the 3 weeks of the Halloween lockdown, The Traitors of Arnhem, The Siege of Heaven and The Siege of Heaven Reader. The Siege of Heaven is about is basically a compilation of articles that I wrote for RT a while ago with a whole load of commentary, bringing them up to date. And The Siege of Heaven Reader is a series of extracts through history, giving an interesting, I think, completely alternative timeline of history, right from medieval times up till today, with a lot of an emphasis on early modern history, things like the Kennedy assassination, that sort of thing. I'll be sending the free versions of those out with my weekly email, which you can subscribe to at our website, thisweek.org.uk. And you can actually even buy them if you want via bilderberg.org or the Borman tab of our show. Sorry to be begging again, but I try not to do that. But you know, that's the way things go nowadays. You need to raise money to pay for these things. And those books were commissioned over the last 4 or 5 years, but never published by the publishers, so I thought I'd better publish them myself. Anyway, also, Greater Manchester Police this week is put in special measures. I can vouch for that, as I've also been trying to deal with them over the last few months. Greater Manchester Police just simply not recording crimes. And goodness knows what they're doing up there with all the taxpayers' money and who's running things, because it sounds like the criminals have got a free pass up in Manchester at the moment. The week's big unpublished stories were probably to do with health workers passing out on camera, or at least they weren't really putting these films on the mainstream press, after having taken the Pfizer vaccine, the mRNA vaccine, and others being rushed to intensive care. One wonders whether they were bullied into it by their employees. So there may be a psychosomatic element to people keeling over after having the vaccine. It may not be a medical thing at all. Also, the worshipful master of the Royal York Lodge in Stroud, Gloucestershire, and former Conservative councillor. He's got an NHS contract to supply PPE, and he made £250 million out of the pandemic, a quarter of a billion. Steve Deacon is his name, and he's been in many of the newspapers, a local profiteer of the pandemic and an inside dealer. Plus, wartime measures for a fake pandemic. We look back at World War II to see some of the similarities between today and when war was announced in 1939 by Neville Chamberlain. Anyway, Martin, I wonder if you have anything to add to thoughts about the pandemonia, can I say that, this week?
Not really, Tony. It's probably better if we just crack on and see what you've come up
with. Well, one of the things is Bristol's been come down into Tier 2 from Tier 3. Do you think that really makes any difference?
Well, I'm quite, like many other people, I'm not quite sure what any of it means.
From 3 to 2?
Yes, it means the pubs are probably going to be open.
And restaurants will be open. Yeah, so it's actually quite a big difference, really. It's going to bring a bit of life back to the city.
Well, I don't think it's going to make much difference. People are going to go to the pub if they want, but most people probably won't. So there you go. Won't you make any difference to the people running the pubs?
I think, you know, if you remember before the Halloween lockdown, evenings were absolutely thronging in town. I think you say most people won't go. I would disagree with you. I think a lot of people will want to go out.
Yeah, well, that may then lead to consequences in the new year, but we shall see.
Why is it, do you think, that this pandemic is going on and on and on, like the war on terror going on and on and on, rather than just for a few months as a normal pandemic would?
Well, because in other parts of the world, Tony, the virus has actually been crushed in China,
no, I'm talking
New Zealand,
about, I'm talking about here.
Well, it hasn't been crushed here because of bad decision-making by the government.
So now I'm asking you a completely separate question about bad decision-making and making political points out of it. Why is this particular COVID-19 virus one that just will not go away? Is the government trying to control something that they can't really control?
Well, don't forget, I was rereading Boris Johnson's speech in February, before we had a lockdown. And he said he was actually bloviating about Brexit and keeping the British economy open. There was a whole paragraph in it which he'd obviously put in there, and he was saying and some countries have to go first and say that we're not going to have lockdowns, we're going to keep the economy open. That's what he said in February. In March he had to lock down. Now, in actual fact, in other words, he completely changed his policy in a space of a month. And then, of course, they locked down. Then they released, we had Eat Out to Help Out, which of course helped Witherspoons but didn't actually help the virus.
Okay, look, Martin, let's just recycle this a bit, because you've got your stuff about, you know, this and that and going backwards and forwards, causing this to go on and on.
Yeah.
Maybe if they'd done nothing at all, this would all be over months and months ago. Maybe it'd been over by June.
Well, you can say that, Tony, but I don't think it's actually, you know, everybody's entitled to an opinion, but the opinion is judged against other opinions.
Yeah, but you're just evading the question. Why is this a pandemic which is going on and on, rather than one that just lasts for a few months like other pandemics?
Well, it may well be, as we've also discussed on this show, that it's a biological warfare agent which is designed
It's our settled view that it probably is.
Well, in that case, don't forget, one of the design features of it is that it's difficult to control, so that you can wreck the economy, so that you can bail out the banks. And of course they wanted to wreck the Chinese economy, but that failed because their intelligence services are too smart.
Boris Johnson, do you think he's going to suffer politically because of this next year?
Well, he's suffered politically in this. He was actually on his highest opinion poll rating ever when he made that speech about how we're going to keep the economy open. He's not on that now, is he?
So is he going to suffer next year, do you think? Is he going to be still running the show?
Well, I think Rishi Sunak and Michael Gove certainly think that he's going to be thrown under the bus.
Do they?
I think they do.
Yeah, but I mean, we've also seen, haven't we, that Keir Starmer's satisfaction rate has been plunging. So he started off fairly well, and... So Keir Starmer's crisis, says the Daily Express, the Labour leader's satisfaction rating plunges halves in 4 months. His satisfaction ratings have nosedived in the 8 months since he took over the reins of the opposition party from Jeremy Corbyn, a new poll has shown. The Labour leader replaced Mr Corbyn in April, 4 months after the party suffered one of its heaviest defeats at the ballot box in modern history. So Keir has worked hard to rebuild Labour's tarnished reputation and broken relationships with Jewish voters, but many in his party believe his approach to handling problems has been heavy-handed. What do you think? Has he been heavy-handed?
Yes, I mean, basically, the so-called anti-Semitism crisis is really exposing the lines of fracture inside the Labour movement, not just the Labour Party, because, of course, it's a lot of it's funded by the trade unions, and they're not very happy with the direction he's taken.
So an opinion poll taken 3 months into his leadership has shown he enjoyed a plus 30% satisfaction rating. This was higher than the approval ratings given to his predecessor Tony Blair. Predecessors Tony Blair, they always start off with this honeymoon period, don't they? But as people get to know him, he's now down only at plus 15.
Yeah, and what he would say is that's a lot better than Jeremy Corbyn. But of course, it's not just about his opinion poll ratings. It's, you know, there's all sorts of other factors need to be taken into account, isn't it?
Like what?
Well, like the fact that this is the biggest crisis in British political history
since
World War II.
So why has Starmer fared so badly here? Surely, I mean, it's an open goal with Boris, isn't it?
Well, it is. I think one of the things that's about, because he's basically messed up this anti-Semitism row, that then reflects on his opinion poll ratings. And I think that's large. I mean, it's a problem of his own making. Because he didn't have to create this huge fight within the Labour Party. But I'm afraid now, I mean, I'm reading Jewish Voice for Labour blog every night now. There's lots of information on there. Anybody's really interested in what's going on in the Labour Party, they should go there. And basically, he's declared war on the left wing of the party. And if you do that, then you get a war. Well, so of course, that's very difficult at that stage to keep your opinion poll ratings up.
So he wants the Tories to fight it out amongst themselves. He's going to stand back and watch them all like cats in a sack fighting over the coronavirus. Sounds to me like, in the meantime, he's not just standing back. He's also taking it out on many of his own party members.
Well, I mean,
if the
stuff he's done on the coronavirus, I don't think is the issue. It is the fact that he's created a war in his own party against the left, which he didn't have to do. It was entirely tactical decision.
Okay, so why is it that voters care what goes on in the internecine struggles of the Labour Party? Sure, they're much more disillusioned with Starmer and his old approach, which is saying, oh, we want more lockdowns, harder and heavier and
well,
longer.
Well, you may say that, but in actual fact, the opinion poll, he's basically, when he said we should have a lockdown in September and the government said no and then they changed their mind and said yes, that didn't make the government look good. He's not actually, I mean, we could go into his COVID strategy if you like, but I think that a lot of his loss of, I mean, certainly on the left, there is a big disillusionment with him because he didn't have to pick a fight, but he chose to. And of course, they're trying to win back red wall voters, which of course is based on the delusion that he can win under first past the post, which he can't because Scotland's going to be independent by 2024. But of course, we may have an election before 2024 because the Tories are going to get rid of the Fixed Term Parliament Act now so that they can then go whenever they feel like. And of course, they've got a majority of 80 so they can do that. But, you know, I think the die is cast on a lot of this now.
So is there anybody else you think that could be running the Labour Party better? If Starmer, as Ipsos Mori are saying, that his ratings have halved in 4 months, it doesn't sound like he's the man to lead Labour into the next general election.
Well, don't forget it's hard because he came in and he had a good, he basically did quite well to begin with. And now, of course, we're getting back to the hardcore stuff, which, you know, you don't necessarily get. I mean, basically, the Tories lost opinion poll massively. I mean, their opinion poll lead was massive at the beginning of the crisis, the COVID crisis, and it's disappeared. So we're now back to even Stevens. So there's been a big change there. And of course, at that point, it starts to get more difficult to win over the hardcore people who are hardcore Tories. I mean, people, when people make their minds up politically, they often make it in their early 20s or teens. And it's very difficult to change their minds thereafter. Those floating voters are actually quite a small minority of the population.
So are you not a floating voter?
No, I'm a member of the Labour Party, as I have been since 1975.
No, but I mean, surely, I mean, there are changes coming, aren't there? It looks as if the Green Party is going to be in the resurgent, particularly with this move internationally towards more green economic policies. And if the Labour Party under Starmer, I mean, it's looking as if it's... do you think then... So I suppose what I'm coming around to saying here is that he knows it's going to be a while till there's a general election, so he's using this time, that he's got a long time to wait for that, in order to get his party members into line.
that's the strategy, but he could have done it. But the point about declaring war on your own left wing is that you can't get rid of them. A lot of what's happening with the
centre. A lot of them are leaving anyway.
Well, a lot of them are leaving anyway. So in that sense, you could say that he regards the 50,000 people who've resigned from the Labour Party since he started this as a plus. And of course, from the point of view of people like me who are staying in the Labour Party, those people are, that's not, doesn't help us. But on the other hand, the fact is that you cannot, that the real problem he's going to have is with the trade union leadership, because they're not necessarily happy about funding what he's doing. So ultimately, it's not just about, you have to have funds to do things. And, giving millions of pounds to insiders in the Labour Party who complained about anti-Semitism, even though the legal advice the party had been given is that they wouldn't win in court. So that's millions of pounds of my subs being given to these people who are basically saboteurs. And McCluskey has already fired a shot over his bows and he would do £1 million from support of the Labour Party. Now, ultimately, what's going to happen with a lot of these anti-Semitism cases is they're going to end up in the courts. And when they get to the courts, the Labour Party leadership are going to lose. You'd have thought somebody who used to be Director of Public Prosecutions, high-flying lawyer, would have realised that ultimately this is all a legal matter, baby, and you can't win. Because under human rights law, which has nothing to do with the EU, you can't stop people saying what they think. And you may say that it's unwise for them to be so pro-Palestinian or whatever, but you can't kick people out of the Labour Party on that basis. And even to try to do it just means that you end up having a fight that you can't win. And if people were wiser around him, they'd have told him that this was a silly strategy, but there you go.
Seems a bit similar to Jeremy Corbyn, very badly advised, no strategy. I mean, all this does, Martin, is it plays into the hands of the hand-rubbing multinationals as they see a British Parliament making such a mess of things, both parties, both sides. There are people out there that love this sort of thing to take place because they know that they are the owners of our world and that they will at some point possibly even just step in, take over as our parliament and civil service, etc., becomes number one, bankrupt, and number two, corrupt.
As we well know, there is a deep state and an establishment which does not want change. And that's what the whole anti-Semitism crisis in the Labour Party is about, orchestrated from the Israeli embassy. And we can say that absolutely confidently because we've got video footage of Shai Mossad, the Mossad man, telling Joan Ryan, who was a Labour MP at the time, that they had £1 million to spend to change Labour policy. There it is, in black and white. And that's what we're up against. And of course, they've now agreed that they're going to appoint an independent panel of Jewish voices to arbitrate on internal disciplinary matters in the Labour Party. So, in other words, the Board of Deputies.
Yeah, but who chooses the independent panel?
Well, indeed, if the independent panel will be chosen by the Board of Deputies of British Jews who are not elected and are conservative voters who are 100% behind the State of Israel. And why anybody in the Labour Party should accept that, I really don't know. And we're not going to accept it, and therefore there's going to be continuous rowing about this. And from Starmer's point of view, the continuous rowing about it may get him lots of claps and cheers from the Daily Mail and the Israeli embassy, but from the average floating voter, it just looks as if he's...
What about your average Labour Party member? Will they be leaving? Or will they
well,
be fighting?
As you know, 50,000 people. I mean, at the height of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, we had the biggest membership in Europe of any political party. Well over 500,000 people. And 50,000 of those people have already ripped up their party cards. And of course, from Starmer's point of view, he wants to take the party back to what it was in the Blair era, where essentially it's a club for people who want to be in Parliament. And, we don't want a mass membership, and we certainly don't want members deciding policy. We want a modernised party, which is a top-down, floating voter-oriented party, and this completely confected anti-Semitism row, and you see, I could easily be disciplined for saying that in the Labour Party, but we've reached the point now where if they try to do that, they're losing everybody. And in any case, if they do try to remove it from the Labour Party, I shall simply take, like everybody else, we'll take them to court.
Jeremy Corbyn, in the meantime, has been launching a new peace project a year after his crushing election defeat, says the Daily Mirror. The MP will set up a body devoted to campaigning for social justice, peace and human rights, 12 months after leading Labour to its worst defeat for 84 years. The Islington North MP who they seem to enjoy repeating this. The Mirror led Labour to its worst election defeat for 84 years a year ago this weekend, is setting up a body devoted to campaigning for social justice, peace and human rights around the world. It is backed by a Labour MP and two prominent trade union figures, including the Unite chief Len McCluskey. I think that Labour MP is Zara Sultana, Coventry yeah. South MP. So this is all a little bit kumbaya. And it seems like the same, sounds like the same Jeremy Corbyn we had in the Labour Party, who basically wanted everybody to do a kind of group hug. Do you think if this is going to get anywhere with this, Martin? Is it a wise move for Jeremy?
Well, I mean, it's basically motherhood and apple pie. I mean, that's the sort of thing he is going to do. Can I just come back on this worst defeat in 85 years? If you actually look at the amount of votes cast, number of votes cast, it's certainly, he got more votes at the last election than Ed Miliband did when he was leader of the Labour Party. And of course, the problem is the electoral system.
It's not. No, it isn't. It's the turnout, because there was a massive turnout in last December's election.
No, it doesn't really.
So you can't compare those two elections.
No, what's actually happened? If you look in the inner cities and the big cities,
you know what, the Labour vote has gone up,
but it doesn't make any difference, because
the really
in the swing constituencies, we didn't win over the red wall.
The really big turnout was in 2016 for the referendum.
Yes, all right, but that's a referendum. It's a different thing.
But the voters saw last December's general election as a referendum on the only really important issue, which is Brexit.
Yes, and the party that won got 43% of the vote and are about to take us into a no-deal Brexit. We'll put at least a million people on the dole next year.
So who's taking us into that no-deal Brexit? Is it Brussels or is it Boris?
Boris, it's Brussels have bent over backwards. They're now trying.
Have they?
I'm afraid they have, Tony.
What, to take our fishing waters?
No, the fishing. Are we going to discuss Brexit? We didn't really discuss it last week. Are we going to do a bit of Brexit now? Should we discuss fishing? Okay, let's discuss fishing.
Well, that's what I just
most
said.
Most of the fishing inside British territorial waters.
You're doing this sort of rhetorical thing.
Okay, well, I'm
you?
Trying to find
just
out
answer
whether
the question.
Whether we've got. Let's discuss. We'll discuss everything about Brexit then. The first thing to do with Brexit is to do with the single market. Now, from the very beginning, it's been clear that you're either in the single market or out of the single market.
Yeah, because if you're in the single market, you have to be under the European Court of Justice.
It's not just that. You have to accept the rules and regulations of the single market. That's what a single market means. Now, there's been basically a dishonest debate about this in the Tory party, where they claim that they can have the pleasure of being in the single market and all the advantages, but they don't want to accept the rules and regs.
Well, that's certainly dishonest, because I think everybody with half a brain knows that you can't do both.
Well, indeed. So, in actual fact, what's happened this week, if we can come up to date, is that the Tory party has finally blinked and accepted that they will have to accept the rules and regs of the single market for a deal. Even though they've said all along to the very last minute, we're not going to have that, they've had to accept it.
Just last night, when it looked as if this deal is basically going to fall apart, it's almost as if when he woke up this morning, Joe Biden has now said that he will not be signing a trade deal with Britain in January.
Well, in any case, you can't sign, trade deals don't work like that. They have to be negotiated over years and then ratified by the Parliament, or the Congress in this case. So the idea that you can do a deal with Trump before he disappears just shows that people don't understand what trade deals are. But of course, plenty of Tory MPs are in this category. They don't understand what trade deals are. Any trade deal with anybody will involve things like arguments about what you can subsidise and what you can't subsidise. And if you want absolute sovereignty, then you don't have trade deals with anybody.
Well, you have.
Not with the EU, not with China, not with anybody. No trade deals. You can leave the WTO as well if you want.
Well, they're not going to do that.
Why not? Because that's an infringement of our sovereignty. We're going to have proper sovereignty,
Martin,
we don't have the WTO.
You're exaggerating. They're going over to WTO. You're exaggerating. They're going over to WTO. That's what almost certainly looks like.
Yes, but the WTO.
Is it going to be the question?
What is the WTO? That's the question, Tony. And if you're in the WTO, there are rules about things like subsidising industries and stuff like that. Yeah. The Chinese were not in the WTO, and then they came into the WTO in 2000. So even if you're in the WTO, you lose sovereignty. But you lose sovereignty to a different set of people than the one you lose sovereignty to in the EU. You'll lose sovereignty to the Chinese. And of course, we could leave the WTO. Some countries are not even in the WTO.
So what do you think about this whole idea of state aid then? Because that's actually quite important if you want a government to be able to have its own trade policy and industrial policy, isn't it?
That's right. And in actual fact, you will find that in Europe, because you've got a variety of different setups there, that they're willing to tolerate a degree of state aid more so than the British. Although, of course, Cummings was going on about fact, he wanted to keep the state aid, get away from the state aid rules, because he wanted the power to just fund his pet project.
It's going to be a bit of a nasty divorce, isn't it, at the end of the year? It was always kind of bound to be like this, especially for people who are Remainers.
Well, I mean, the people who are Remainers, like myself, we have resigned ourselves to the fact that we're leaving. But the problem is going to be for the leavers, because in actual fact, it's going to be far, far worse. I mean, the Office of Budget Responsibility, which is basically a tame government organisation, says we're going to lose 2% of GDP next year because of a no-deal Brexit and 300,000 jobs. Now, those 300,000 jobs won't be in the sectors which have been affected by COVID, like hospitality. It's going to be in sectors like manufacturing. Now, you saw Sir James Ratcliffe, who was going to open his new car factory in South Wales, is now opening it in France because they've got better access to the single market, even though he's a big Brexiter.
I mean, surely, I mean, okay, so this disaster in terms of industry, surely the job of the central government and the city is to actually make sure that that manufacturing happens here in the UK and invest in manufacturing, because any manufacturing that is left, which is very little here in Britain, is going to have a wider market here in the UK itself.
Yeah, but we're now getting to the nitty-gritty economics of leaving the European Union. The British market simply isn't big enough for Sir James Ratcliffe's Land Rover.
Also, these goods will go backwards and forwards still. It's just that there'll be tariffs on them.
Yeah, in other words, they become uncompetitive. And don't forget...
It makes British industry more competitive, surely.
No, it doesn't, because you can't get into the European market. We haven't got to the fish
To the
yet.
Domestic market.
No, yeah, but... Yeah, but to the, well, the
do you want to do fish then? Come on.
Okay, well...
as British as fish and
chips. No, because the fish is less important.
So we'll have fish, but nothing else. Were we after this deal?
Well, no. The fish issue is also linked with this question about state aid and rules of the single market. So what the EU is saying about the fishing situation is, yes, we'll have to have a transition to you controlling your own waters. Now, of course, in actual fact, we
Not
don't
another transition.
Yeah, well, transitions are inevitable unless you're just going to crash the car, Tony. And of course, we are going to crash the car. It's not clear that we will get a no-deal Brexit. So it may be that the deal will be done. And then that puts, that becomes interesting politically, because Starmer wants to vote for a deal, but plenty of people in his own party don't want to do that. The SNP will definitely abstain, for example. So will the Greens. So will Plaid Cymru.
I would imagine Starmer will do whatever the Bilderbergers tell him to do.
Well, what
do they want?
Well, yes, what they want is, you know, well, anyway, we'll come back to them in a minute, because they're another force, if you like.
Well, they're very much a pro-EU force.
They were historically so,
They
yes.
have been involved in the creation of both the Euro and the EU.
Yes, okay.
And their basic idea is, well, we want a system where failed politicians who are voted out by ordinary people get put in charge of the European Commission and run the show.
The reason why we have a European Commission is because if we had Europe-wide elections, the European Parliament executive would then become more powerful than local politicians in Britain, France, Germany, or anywhere else. And that's why you've got this superstructure which isn't elected, so that because ultimately, you see, if we had proper elections to a European Parliament, the Prime Minister of Britain becomes a non-entity. So we don't have that. And of course, coming back to the fishing. The argument about the fishing is simply this, that most of the fish that we eat, cod is what we eat in this country, and that's caught either in EU waters, Norwegian waters, or further out to sea. Most of the fish that's caught inside our territorial waters, as will we be, are mackerel and pilchards, which we don't eat. And
we're going to have to get used to it.
Well,
battered pilchards for tea.
Well, yes, and of course the point is that the European skippers bought the British quotas on all of that years ago, because British trawlers go out to the deep sea to catch cod. What you've got with the French fishermen and so on is that they come and catch the pilchards and the mackerel, which they then eat. You know, if you go to Holland, you know, they eat loads and loads of pickled herring. They like it. And of course, what Barnier said is, if you really want to push us out of those waters, you can do that. But then we will not buy your mackerel and herring if you've brought. And of course, the other thing about it is
Hang on. Where are those poor Belgians going to get their mackerel and herring?
Well, they'll get them somewhere
else. Will it be
on
the black market?
They'll get them somewhere else.
They'll be smuggling herring and mackerel over to the Belgian coast.
The other thing is, when we talk about controlling your own territorial waters, an individual fishing boat or fishing company can have ownership anywhere. Yeah? It's just a question of what the flag is on the boat.
Mauritania, maybe.
Yeah, well, exactly.
So do you think there's going to be a kind of war with the British... well, I don't know if we've got any battleships left. I think it'd probably
no,
be...
No, they're all in the South China Sea, helping our sovereignty.
A frigate or something like that, having a little bit of a clash with a French trawler.
Well, I mean, if the British do try and do unilateral things like that, it's quite simple. They won't let British fishermen or any land their catches
on
the continent.
You say it's a unilateral. You're so one-sided. I mean, it would surely the Navy would only get involved if a French trawler came within British waters, and they can then have a bit of a tussle, can't they? They can get close to each other. The trawler could maybe even trail some cables, which might snake around the screws of the frigate and slow it down. And you could also get the frigate maybe cutting the nets of the trawlers or whatever ships are going to use. I mean, this is basically naval battle, isn't it?
Yeah, but if that happens, it's quite simple. They won't allow British fishermen to land their catches and sell them in the European Union. You will have to sell them somewhere else. And things like fish, you can't actually sell to the Chinese unless you're going to pickle the lot
of it. So is it going to be just cod and New Zealand lamb our diet next year?
Well, we don't know. what's going to happen is there are going to be massive increases in prices.
The New Zealanders are still talking to us, aren't they? I don't know about that.
Well, perhaps we can send our fishing fleet over there. Anyway, the point is that we will see. We've been predicting... us Remainer economists all along that this was not going to be very good for
the British
economy.
To be fair, you have also been predicting some sort of economic reset crash.
Oh, that's coming
too.
Could
Brexit be a trigger for some sort of economic disaster?
Well, Brexit is a symptom of the dysfunctional nature of global capitalism.
Yes or no? Could Brexit trigger something wider? If it's a no deal...
If it's a no deal Brexit, it's more likely to, for sure. But the real problem is going to be, as you say, there are other problems in the international financial system which have nothing to do with Brexit. But Brexit came about because of austerity to a large extent, which was a stupid policy in the first place.
Not about migration?
Well, but you get migration. I mean, it was the British government under Tony Blair who pushed to extend the European Union into the eastern countries quicker than the French and the Germans wanted to. And it was the Americans backing the British who pushed for that. And in actual fact, at one stage, the Germans got into the regulations that they would only take a certain amount of migration from Eastern Europe. The British said, stuff that, we'll have any number. And of course, that was an error. And of course, that then led to people thinking they're being overwhelmed by Polish plumbers, etc., etc. But anyway, you're going to get more migration in any case because of it was the British and the French who smashed the Libyan state and then opened the door. The Italians were totally against doing that.
But we've got
but they've ended up with all the people on Lampedusa, not us.
We've got a double whammy, haven't we? We've got all of the the lack of economic activity due to the corona lockdowns. We've got that to start with, and we've also got potentially Brexit. I mean, isn't this the kind of perfect storm that might lead to something?
Yes.
Well, and we've also had, haven't we, in the background, we've had people like Klaus Schwab and Prince Charles saying, oh, it's okay, you know, when the economy collapses, we will be ready here next year, we've got something called the Great Reset, which will reset the financial system.
Well, what Boris Johnson could have done, and Barnier thought he would, is said, well, you can carry on having a transition. We've got another 2 years before you have to leave. And of course, we didn't even start the clock. You only start the clock when you pass Article 501 or what it was. And so that was passed immediately after the referendum, but you didn't have to do that. So the reason why it's all happening so quickly is because the Brexit faction in British politics were determined to get it through as fast as possible before anybody could change their minds. That's why we're doing it at such a rate. There's no reason to rush at it like a bull at a gate, but we have, and we're here with 2 weeks to go.
Rushed at it as like a bull in a gate. It's been 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020. That's 4 years.
Yes, but once you've decided to leave the European Union, you've then got to decide what the divorce... You say, you make a decision, right, we're going to get divorced. I'm going back to mother. And then, of course, that isn't just a decision where you walk out and go back to mother. Who's going to get the CDs? Who's going to get the pets? Yeah, and that's what the 4 years has been about. And we're still with 2 weeks to go, we haven't decided who's going to get the PCDs.
Well, I think there's been
pets.
Quite a lot of thought put into it, so we shall see. We shall see what happens. We've also got, of course, happening around the same time, or just after the new year, the announcement about Julian Assange and whether he's going to be extradited. Even some, I think it was fake news I was reading this week, about Trump trying to pardon Julian Assange. I know he'd done that before, but Assange wouldn't admit his guilt, so... he wasn't up for a plea bargain. Very brave of him to do
that.
Not,
well, it's not that was a behind the scenes offer. So it's the, you know, it was never officially put on the table.
It was in some of the nationals in the States.
No, I'm just saying. But there was no.
But so what do you, what's your best guess? Because we will probably be reporting on this when we come back in the first week of January, Martin, after the new year, about what's happening with Assange. What's your best guess?
I don't know about that. I mean, as you know, you interviewed Assange's father, and he was of the opinion that they were starting to get cold feet about the whole thing. And it may be the problem with they've dug themselves into a hole here. If they had been more softly with Assange, they could have just let him go and forgotten about it. But since they've bigged him up as the worst criminal since the Joker, they can't just release him. So that's their dilemma.
Yes, it's annoying, isn't it? And you know, I'd like to think that we still have some sort of integrity in this country, that we wouldn't say someone who is actually a journalist, he's not a spy. I mean, why is it that how can the Americans get away with saying he's a spy and not a journalist, Martin? How?
Well, they can. The whole case, frankly, is. An abomination.
They just don't like what he says, do they?
Further than that, I don't think there is a case to answer here. And you'd have thought that the former head of Director of Public Prosecutions, Sir Keir Starmer, and of course he has said absolutely nothing about this. And of course,
although he did nod it through when he was Director of Public
Prosecutions. Well, indeed. So in other words, he's on the wrong side of this. I cannot see that there is any basis in British common law for Assange to be charged with anything.
He's on the wrong side of most of the... In fact, all of the ones, Jimmy Savile too, quashing two attempts by Surrey police to prosecute Savile while he was still alive. Keir Starmer throws him in the rubbish bin.
Well, I'll tell you who is on the right side of the Assange case, and that's Balthazar Garzon, the campaigning magistrate from Spain, the one who sent the extradition request for Pinochet, the one who sent the socialist interior minister Inigo to prison for 10 years as a terrorist. That's having an independent judiciary like in Bozzimato in Italy, who named NATO as the bombers of Bologna railway station. That's what a director of public prosecution should be. Starmer is a cardboard cutout compared to those people.
Okay, well, we're going to go and have a listen now to this week's Prime Minister's questions. And here is Mr. Starmer's last attempt, well, they've gone into recess now, before Christmas and the New Year, to make Boris look stupid, which is kind of his job, really, asking the most awkward possible questions that Boris can't answer. Let's see how Keir Starmer did.
Keir Starmer.
Here we go again, Mr. Speaker, ignoring the medical advice. And we know where that leads, because we've seen what happened in the last 9 months. And whatever the Prime Minister says, there's no escaping the brutal facts that Britain has one of the highest number of COVID deaths in Europe and the worst economic damage. Mr. Speaker, as this is the last PMQs of the year, I, for one, often wonder where the Prime Minister gets his advice from. Well, now I know, because I've heard the official newsletter of the Wellingborough Conservative Party. It's not on everyone's Christmas reading list, but it is a fascinating read, because it gives a lot of advice to wannabe politicians. It says this: say the first thing that comes into your head. It'll probably be nonsense. You may get a bad headline, but if you make enough dubious claims fast enough, you can get away with it. And it includes the December edition. The advice: sometimes it's better to give the wrong answer at the right time rather than the right answer at the wrong time. So my final question to the Prime Minister is this: is he the inspiration for the newsletter, or is he the author?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think what the people of this country would love to hear from the Right Honourable Gentleman this season of of goodwill is any kind of point of view at all on some of the key issues. I mean, this week he couldn't make up his mind whether it was right for kids to be in school or not, and havering completely. He couldn't make up his mind last week whether or not to support what the government was doing to fight COVID, and told his troops heroically to abstain. He couldn't make up his mind about Brexit, you'll seem to remember. We don't know whether he'll vote for a deal or not. Mr. Speaker, he can't attack the government. He can't attack the government if he can't come up with a view of his own. Mr. Speaker, in the words of the song, from All I Want for Christmas is a View, Mr. Speaker. And it'd be wonderful if he could produce one. This government is getting on with delivering on the people's priorities. We're 20,000 more police, 50,000 more nurses, 48 new hospitals, and Mr. Speaker. And although it has been very tough and very difficult, and everybody appreciates the suffering and hardship that the people of this country have been going through, we are, by rolling out the vaccine, by community testing, and by tough tiering, which I hope he supports, we are going to defeat coronavirus, Mr. Speaker, and we're going to take this country forward into a great 2021.
So who do you think won that, Martin?
Well, I mean, people are going to have their partisan views on it, aren't they?
But it's all a little bit childish, isn't it, really?
Well, I'm afraid Prime Minister's questions has always been a bit childish.
But it is, but it isn't. It doesn't need to be. Sometimes there are some, you know, actually fairly sensible and pointed questions asked. This is just a cheap shot here. And to be fair, Boris is just cheap shotting back.
Well, indeed. I mean, as you know, Tony, although we listen to Prime Minister's questions every week on this show, I've never regarded as particularly enlightening.
Okay, so I thought we'd have a chat. We were due to have Harley Ford and Nate Turner on here from Stand Up Bristol, neither of whom could make it for various reasons. I'm still trying to get Harley on the phone, and we'll see how we get on with him. I did speak this week to a chap called Adam Scarborough. Now, Adam is a former mental nurse and a former armoury officer. Well, actually, no, he's a mental nurse now, trained in mental nursing, and an army officer. And he had some pretty striking things to say this week about the police treatment of demonstrators. Martin, before we hear from Adam, what he's basically saying here is that as demonstrators are just standing there, peacefully, the police are charging into them. This is at Monday outside Parliament Square because there was some sort of coronavirus debate going on. There was a demo, people turn up, and the police are just charging into the crowd.
So what do you want me to say about
that? Yes, I mean, this is okay, is it?
I don't know what happened on that particular occasion, so it's hard for me to comment.
Okay, well, that's an interesting answer, a very political politician's answer, that one. Let's have a listen to Adam anyway to see what he had to say about it. He's a mental health nurse, and he's been going along to many of these protests, he told me.
I know when I did my psychiatric course that isolation is one of the biggest causes of mental illness. There's anyone's read Desmond Morris, zoologist Desmond Morris, Naked Ape, you'll find out there's a thing called anti-explorational behaviour. As human beings, we are social animals. We need company. We're creatures of habit. And when that social side of us is taken away, it has an adverse effect on our behaviour. And may I say that the term social distancing is just one big oxymoron, because there is nothing social about distancing. It's the opposite to being social. And in itself, it's quite a worrying concept to say social distancing. It's almost bringing forward a notion, paradoxically, that being distant is social. So the term in itself is quite cruel, I think.
Have you been along to any of these demonstrations?
I see it as a duty, and I've been along to virtually everyone since it started, since Piers' first arrest in Hyde Park. And it's impossible, to be quite honest, to not conclude that the police aren't politically motivated, to give the impression, as you rightly just said, that they're dealing with a violent bunch of people. Tony, nothing could be further from the truth. There's professionals, there's doctors. I mean, I never thought I'd see the day that a doctor, a qualified doctor, this German doctor, was thrown into the back of a meat wagon for the terrible crime of just speaking. I mean, something's wrong when that happens to a society. And I feel it, you know, you either sit back and you take this, or you peacefully demonstrate. There was no aggression from the demonstrators at all. Had the police have not been there, in quite honestly, you do not need the police there. The police are the antagonists. If they weren't there, there would be no trouble at all. It'd be like a peaceful picnic in the park. All the trouble is, look, on Wednesday, if you speak to David Curtin, Merrill, London Assembly member, he will tell you the same thing. The police were the antagonist, and they're there purely to cause trouble. It's so sad because they're arresting people. They're giving people criminal records now, going to ruin people's lives. And this malpractice has to stop, which is why I've written to my MPs about it before something serious happens.
Okay. So what have you said to your MP?
Well, I basically did a version of the letter that you read, basically saying that the health and safety factors, that, you know, the police demand risk assessments, and then in one big contradiction, they start beating the hell out of people for no good reason. It's one big contradiction, yet they at the same time they demand risk assessments. I mean, that's a very audacious thing to do. And I think, you know, along those lines, that in a democratic society, myself and other soldiers, we all fought for a free society. The right to demonstrate is the hallmark of a free society. If you take that freedom away, if you look at the amount of laws that are going through, the amount of acts that all may I say under a Conservative government, whether it's the Digital Economies Bill, whether it's the Investigatory Powers Act, whether it's the Online Harms Act that's going through, and more frighteningly, this Covert Criminal Intelligence Act, which is going through at the moment, which will basically give the police the right to torture with impunity. And then there's Priti Patel's other one, which is called, ironically named, Protection of the Public Bill. So in her mind, in that woman's mind, God knows what's going on in there, taking away freedoms, taking away the right to demonstrate, is protecting the public. I mean, try and get your head around that one. So these oppressive laws, I think, have to be challenged, or the dystopian state won't take place overnight. If it was to take place overnight, it would be all too obvious what happens. So they have to do it in a sort of tapering, step-by-step fashion, where we lose freedom by freedom, and then they sort of test the public to see how gullible they are, and then we'll come. And every law that they make, every repressive law that they make, is a precursor for another retrogressive law to come in. It's not going to stop until we're left doing the Times crossword puzzle or watching old Mother Riley movies on TV.
Yeah. So I know in your letter you say something about you believe that there are going to be more demonstrations to come.
Well, I think because, you know, the Prime Minister's not given any indication as when this is going to end. I mean, people now, you know, back in April when it started, they were considering this, it would be over in a few weeks. Now we're coming towards the end of the year. It's now pushing a year since we've had this, since last, was it April, March, when it first lockdown happened. And I think inevitably, especially now, people are losing their jobs. I mean, I was walking down the Strand the other day in central London. Every business, including some of the oldest shops in England, are now closed down in one of the richest streets in London, near the, just adjacent to the Savoy Hotel. So when you see people losing things like that, I think the amount of resistance is going to increase. I can't see any other way. So yes, I think
you also said. Yeah. I mean, you also said something about you believe that the police are now using military tactics. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that, from what I've seen of the TSG, they're basically like a military wing of the state. When they're attacking, their hands on each shoulders, they make a sort of, I don't know, you could describe it as a sort of monkey noise that they make before they charge into the crowd. And then it's what I've seen, it was almost like with all the zeal of military attack on innocent, defenseless people, totally disproportionate to what was going on. And I found it like every other one, because the idea that a policeman is like some sort of Dixon and Doc Green fantasy figure that will cuff you on the shoulder and tell you to go home, they were anything but. And they were big guys, big scary men to the average woman or man, who would either put you into the flight or flight syndrome, which either means you stand your ground or you run away. And by running away, they're also using snatch squads as well, which is very, 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 how can I say, like nonchalantly walking up to you and then making a quick grab for you. This is a very cruel way of grabbing anyone in the vicinity. I've seen that quite a lot. And someone's going to get seriously hurt. I mean, I've seen people knocked unconscious. I've seen people with cranial wounds, very, very bloody. And when you see that, that's when the police start to worry a bit. Because, you know, they like the George Floyd thing in America, I counted the minutes he was unconscious for George Floyd. And they're so used to assaulting people, Tony, that they don't realise that they too can go to coroner's court and they are responsible for their actions. It's not just about following orders. There is a conscience clause. They are responsible for their own actions.
So that's Adam Scarborough there. He was served in the British Army in the Falklands, and he is absolutely disgusted to see, Martin, the behaviour of the police weighing into peaceful demonstrators outside Parliament this week and previous occasions.
Well, the things he's describing there are, frankly, standard police tactics, which I've seen used many times over the decades I've been a protester.
So there's nothing new to this dystopian state, then? It's all just been happening
I'm just saying that the tactics he's describing are normal tactics, which are often used. Whether they're right or not is another matter. I think, you know, people are, you know, in my mind, often the police do, in fact, behave in
a way. But, I mean, things are ramping up, aren't they? The things are most definitely ramping up. You're just trying to brush over that. They're trying to remove the right to demonstrate.
What the legal position is about this is that because of the COVID restrictions and not having more than certain numbers of people in one place, that they are enforcing those. And of course, that's supposedly, as we all know, not a normal circumstance, et cetera, et cetera. But I can tell you now, over many years, when we've had no COVID restrictions whatsoever, the police have often cracked people. I mean, I've seen it in Bristol here, just up the road in the so-called Tesco riot, where the MP.
Martin, you can't compare the Tesco riot where people
wasn't a riot, Tony.
Burning waste bins and things like that. It's not the same as people.
But you know very well what happened there. Hundreds of police were brought in from outside the city, and the MP Kerry McCarthy, her worker was whacked over the head with a riot baton. They had Heckler and Koch submachine guns to deal with what was. There was no protest. Yeah, there was nothing happening when the police arrived. And it had all come about because of what had happened in the so-called Telegraph Heights squat, which I think was a provocation. Now, in other words, your ex-army guy is just coming to terms with the fact that this is what's been going on for years. In the miner strike, 6 people died. 4 of them were killed by the police.
Okay, so also this thing called the the Protection of the Public Bill. This is all getting very Orwellian, isn't it? Protection of the Public Bill means you can't demonstrate anymore.
Yes, and of course the other thing he didn't mention, which should be mentioned, is the carte blanche for British military forces serving abroad. They're allowed to do whatever they like, but of course we know what the Australian SAS are now in the firing line because they've been just killing civilians at random in Afghanistan. And I bet you the British SAS have got a few stories to tell about that as well.
Well, looking at the criminalisation of the British state, which we've been hearing quite a lot about in the last 5 minutes there, Dominic Cacciani at the BBC, their Home Affairs correspondent and press officer for MI5, Dominic Cacciani says that MI6 may be committing crimes in the UK right now. MI6 agents and informants may be committing crimes in Britain, a watchdog has revealed. The Investigatory Powers Tribunal disclosed the ruling despite the government attempts to keep the matter secret. Well, it sounds the government seems to be acting like a criminal gang here. When it's found to be breaking the law, they do everything they can to stop anyone knowing about it. This is why journalism at the moment is so important. It's also said, question thinking of Julian Assange, challenge. It also says questions raised should be disclosed to campaigners who have been asking for greater legal clarity over what the intelligence services can and cannot do. It comes a day after the intelligence services watchdog raised its own questions about some MI6 activities. Since 1994, the Foreign Intelligence Service has been able to authorise people that it recruits to help the UK overseas to commit crimes as part of its targeting of threats to the UK. The power has been dubbed the James Bond Clause, but it does not explicitly permit criminal operations in the UK. However, it seems that MI6 has been bending the rules and doing it in the UK anyway, because they know no one's really keeping an eye on them, Martin.
Well, all that's true, and it's, and of course, the reason they've brought forward these, both the military and the intelligence services bills, is to basically regularise what they've been doing for years anyway. That's what they've been up to. I mean, Dave Shaler and Annie Machon exposed that MI6 were involved in a bomb attack in Libya, which was supposed to kill Gaddafi, but actually just killed loads of innocent bystanders. They've been doing this for years. And in any case, the other let out clause they have is that their agents, actually to say, you know, people who are on MI6's official list of agents, are one thing. But of course, you usually operate through cutouts. So you just basically put other people up to doing the things that you don't want to do yourself. So the extraordinary rendition, for example, is when they take somebody, they capture somebody, they say, right, are you going to tell us X, Y, or Z, or we're going to hand you over to the Egyptians? And they, of course, have no rules about what they can and can't do to you. And of course, that's standard procedure. And the CIA doesn't directly torture people itself. It just gives them to its henchmen. Well,
this is interesting, isn't it? Because this modus operandi has obviously been picked up over here in the UK. Undercover informants working for the police and MI5 are being explicitly permitted for the first time under British law to commit crimes. But isn't it interesting how it's exactly the same sort of thing? It's saying, well, actually, what we're going to do is we're going to say that all these cutouts that we've been using for years to do all this dodgy activity are going to be above the law.
Yes, and of course, the Pat Finucane case, the government said it isn't going to investigate it. Brian Nelson, who was the chief intelligence officer of the UDA for many years, in other words, the head honcho, was working for Brigadier Gordon Kerr, head of the Force Research Unit of the British Army. And basically, in other words, the whole of the Loyalist Terror campaign was being orchestrated by the British Army. So when people say we're going to lose our freedoms if this, that and the other happens, of course, what's happening now is it's all coming out into the open. But what's being exposed is stuff that's been going on for years. The bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, which killed 27 people, the biggest single death toll of one day of the Troubles, were carried out by the Glenane Gang, which was a loyalist paramilitary, but the explosives were supplied by MI5. Garda Síochána are well aware of that. So in other words, this stuff has been going on for years and years and years while Middle England was busy having a cup of tea and watching Mother Riley movies.
Well, we just heard from one military officer. Let's have a listen now to another one. And this guy is called Leslie Kenderisi, and he's working, a Canadian officer, who decided to go and join a protest over in Toronto to make his views felt about the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine. And here he is. He starts off by explaining that he's there to salute the crowd, and he gives the crowd a salute in Toronto.
I'd like to salute all of you. I'm going to speak plain English. That you have the balls and the courtesy to come out and tell the government of Canada that tyranny doesn't rule over Canadians. And it's unfortunate that I have to come here. And I'm asking, basically, some of the military that, General retired Hilliard was going to be working with the Canadian government to distribute this killer vaccine, I have to call it. The reason is because nobody knows what this vaccine will do to your body. A couple of months into investigating with the vaccine what it will do, nobody knows. It could affect your body next month, 5 years, 10 years, nobody knows. For us to take the vaccine, I think it's criminal. The indemnification for these vaccine companies is that you have to sign a piece of paper, basically, that they're not liable if you get sick, or you die. So just on those grounds, I'm not going to get into all kinds of theories, but just on those grounds, on those grounds, I don't know if I'm going to take the vaccine.
Why the hell would you?
Thank you. I'm asking military right now serving, truck drivers, medical, engineers, whatever you are, do not take this unlawful order in distribution of this vaccine. Major General, retired also, Denny Ferton. He was retired from head of NATO. So there's a couple of guys in there that are retired, working for the government now, who are working on the distribution of this vaccine. I'm asking these guys, listen, you guys were wearing a uniform before. We took an oath, same as these police officers, who are protecting you guys. That's their job. My job is protecting them, protecting you, not just from foreign, but also from domestic. I might be in a lot of shit for doing this, but I don't care anymore. I just want to say something else quickly. I left the country in 1974 that was under communism. I joined the cadets because I saw a lot of stuff back there that I didn't appreciate, and I'm not going to, I swore basically that I'm not going to stand for and I'm not going to run again. That's communism or socialism. Canada is democratic and it's going to stay that way. Thank you guys, and don't give up the fight. Congratulations, I salute you.
That was Leslie Kenderesi, K-E-N-D-E-R-E-S-I, Leslie, L-E-S-L-I-E, Canadian officer Martin, making it pretty clear he thinks that he actually calls it a killer vaccine. And he says that because he's saying it hasn't been tested. Nobody knows what this vaccine is going to do.
Yeah, I think the biggest questions are about the Pfizer vaccine because it's very expensive as well. And of course, the CEO of Pfizer carried out an insider trading scam where he basically, the announcement was made that they found the vaccine or developed the vaccine, and he'd made an arrangement to sell his shares and buy them back at the old price, which made, you know, put millions of pounds in his pocket. I think that, you know, the question about the vaccines really brings up the whole question about Western Big Pharma and what motivates them anyway. They basically aren't there to cure people of anything. But of course, vaccines in general, not necessarily so. I mean, there are other competing vaccines being developed, particularly by the Russians, the Chinese, the Cubans, etc., which are not being developed to make a profit. And they, of course, they could still be dangerous. And it may well be that the way to deal with this virus isn't to vaccinate people. It's just to do the right things in terms of disease control.
Well, some people have done extremely well out of all of this. And one of them is a chap called Steve Deccan, lives in Stroud, or lived in Stroud. He's now sold up and he's bought a massive farm for his family because he's made so much money out of these PPE contracts. 276 million in PPE contracts has bought him now a nice little country manor, whereas his firm beforehand was making a £500,000 annual loss. It's now turning over £250,000, and he's made himself a load of money out of this. Now, he's a Freemason. He's a master of the Royal York Lodge in Stroud. He's a former Conservative councillor. Martin, this does seem like Freemasonry here being used as a way to make connections to get some sort of contract there. And I mean, we've had Annalisa, I can't remember the second name, who's the Shadow Chancellor.
Dodds.
Her pointing out that these contracts have been awarded on the rush, saying, oh, it's an emergency procedure. We can't advertise them out all around the country because we need the contract straight away. We'll just give them to our mates like Steve Deccan.
Well, that's clearly what has happened, and the National Audit Office has already said so. And, of course, what the Tory chumocracy are hoping is that by the time any investigation is taken into all of this, everybody will have moved on and forgotten all about it. What should have happened, obviously, is that the NHS
should have been prepared for
a pandemic and should have had everything ready to go.
Deccan was given £120 million contract to supply masks. He later received a further £156 million to provide gowns and masks. Neither contract went through any competitive tender process. He established direct contact with the DHSC at the start of the first wave, offering the equipment via a British contact in Hong Kong, who in turn used a company in southern China to manufacture the goods. All done just on a phone call. Yeah, you got the contract. Go for it.
Yeah, and in actual fact, what the government have said about these contracts that you've been given on the fly is, A, yes, as you say, it's all an emergency, so we can't follow the normal procedures. And B, that people who knew ministers or had personal contacts were 10 times more likely to get a contract than people who just speculatively put. And they tried to justify that, saying, well, we kind of know who these people are. And of course, that you would have thought that in actual fact, the people who you know who they are, you'd have been doubly sure to make sure that they didn't necessarily get the contracts. But that's not what's happened, is it?
I think it's just coincidence. He also happens to be master of one of the big lodges in Stroud.
I don't think it's a coincidence at all. It's more likely that the contacts you make by being that allow you to, I mean, you can imagine that at a certain point, the government knows they're going to put in loads of PPE contracts, and they immediately tell people like Matt Hancock's former mate who ran a pub, who used to be in the army as well, remember, he was another ex-army officer, and of course many of these people who've got the contracts have got no background in actual supply of this kind of goods. They're just business people of a general stripe, like the guy who, you know, the Matt Hancock's mate, had no background in, he basically was a publican, but he ended up supplying PPE to the government.
It just does rather remind me of Philip Judd, and I'm not saying that every Freemason is a bad Freemason, but Philip Judd was the master of a lodge. He was also a Conservative, but he was rather more senior than Steve Deccan. He was the mayor of Weston-super-Mare. He was found to, his computer laptop was found to contain hundreds of images of child pornography. And then he was banged up for several years, but that was only something that took place after Colin Port had removed. I mean, it was a prosecution that had been sitting on the chief constable's desk, and the chief constable hadn't done anything about it. Nobody knew about it really, apart from maybe a few detectives. And then when Nick Gargan took over as chief constable, he immediately got things moving, and this Conservative councillor went to jail. So it does look as if there are some pretty high level connections here between Freemasons in the law enforcement service, government contractors in the National Health Service, etc., and Tory councillors.
Well, the
MPs, or yeah, well, I mean, politicians.
Freemasonry, as we well know, Tony, is a mechanism by which insiders try to, look after each other. But it's not the only mechanism. There'll be other ways.
It's just a nice little club where people go to talk about God.
That's what they say. I'm not denying that there are plenty of issues about Freemasonry, but Matt Hancock's mate who used to run a pub wasn't a Freemason. He just happened to know Matt Hancock, and that was good enough.
Well, one of the interesting things about the craft, as they call it, is the links to the Knights Templar. This is, I think, absolutely crucial to understand that Freemasonry, these people are not about building cathedrals. They are really a network that was created after the destruction of the Knights Templar by the French King Philip the Fair in medieval times. And so the Templars just infiltrated the craft Freemasons guilds, and all of the various things like the murder of Hiram Abiff, this is all just a way of saying, well, you know, we're going to rebuild. They're not going to rebuild the Temple of Solomon. They're going to rebuild the Knights Templar. That's their actual objective. So it's this. I mean, I remember James Garrett and his brilliant documentary on HTV, Martin, in the 1990s, talked about it as a religious cult.
Yes, but it certainly doesn't go back to the Knights Templars. It's basically from the 18th century, and of course they claimed to be related to previous incarnations of masonry going back to the Knights Templars. But it's basically a lot of 18th century made up stuff.
Well, what I'm saying is that the Templars went underground. They went into the Masons' guilds for several centuries.
Well, and then I would dispute that.
Then they came out in the 18th century in 1717.
That is the official story that Freemasonry says. I mean, that Hermes Trismegistus is supposedly the father of Freemasonry, who is basically an Egyptian and all the rest of it. That aspect of it, I'm afraid, as an amateur historian, all of that stuff was made up by the Freemasons themselves in the 17th and 18th centuries.
They don't themselves say that they are the real Knights Templar, do they?
No, but they say that they've got antecedents going back to ancient Egypt and so on.
They do have this Royal Arch Masonry, which is a whole point of that is that you are a Knights Templar Mason. So there are aspects to that. I just think it's it's a bit like the Jehovah's Witnesses, another thing which actually is run by many Masons. The Mormons too. A lot of these are just religious cults, and as soon as you get anywhere near the top, you realise who's in charge, and it's certainly not the people who are supposedly the members of the organisation. Anyway, so that's Steve Deccan, £276 million, master of the Royal York Lodge in Stroud, of PPE contracts. But he's not the only one, Martin, is there's quite a lot of these conservatives. He's actually one of the ones that's won the least number of contracts, some of them going even higher.
Yeah, I mean, there's the National Audit Office have already flagged up that this is all irregular. There is ultimately going to be some kind of inquiry into all of this, like there was into the Iraq War. But of course, by that
isn't the financial meltdown going to be paid to all that?
Well, maybe the nuclear war will preempt the financial meltdown, Tony. I mean, we really are in end times, as you constantly stressing.
Well, maybe, but anyway, PPE, the COVID arcs, are washed with your tax millions, from the pigeon controller to the yoghurt maker. They're unlikely business people who became as rich as oligarchs on the PPE gravy train. Excellent article in the, I think that's the Mail on Sunday, actually, on the 11th of December. That's actually, no, it's the Daily Mail. It's this time last week. So I'll put a link up to that on our show page at this week. .org.uk. But I thought we'd have another look, Martin, at one of the more interesting aspects, which you're often bringing up about COVID-19, is its link to being a potential bioweapon. And as you remember, back in January this year, the first week in January, 7th of January, before we were hoofed off FM by BCFM's manager Pat Hart, citing that he didn't want to have any Ofcom complaints that might appear because he didn't have the time to do it. And I've just, by the way, put in my little letter to the board asking them to have another look at that this week, which is just talking about the way in which it was done and completely no communications allowed with me, just a whole series of orders sent to me, to my email. Then I reply trying to get a meeting and a discussion and nothing happens. So hopefully something will now. So is this whole aspect of the AIDS side of this COVID-19? Because, Martin, the common cold doesn't normally get associated with AIDS, does it?
Yeah, well, I mean, what's interesting about it is COVID we're talking about now is the incubation period where people don't show symptoms, or that some people don't show symptoms at all, because that means it's very difficult to control it, and that would be a design feature of a biological weapon. I sent you an article which came out Monday, from Larry Romanoff, who's based in Shanghai, about all of this. The other thing, there's a lot of information in there. People can look it up themselves if they want to look. Maybe we can put a link up to it.
That's funny, because I got halfway through that. I thought, this is great. I tried to share it on Facebook, and Facebook said, you're not allowed to share anything.
Yeah, but it would be likely. What he points out is very interesting. As you know, there are various strains of COVID, because we've had this big panic. There's a new strain in this country, etc. Now, in actual fact, in China, they've only had two strains of COVID, I think it is, and they're not the original strains. The place where they've had all of the strains of COVID is, guess where?
The United States.
And that suggests that it is the United States, which was where the first cases must have been.
Okay, so the article's called COVID-19 Unexplained by Larry Romanoff. It's on the UNZ.com. Waves, ripples and surges, he said. Now, he does a pretty good examination of all the different ways that the COVID-19 is supposedly keeps coming back again and again. I mean, I'm reminded of the We're Not Going Back to Normal article, which I think we used on the first show we did, Martin, after when I was in New Zealand, after they announced the lockdowns. On Massachusetts Institute of Technology website, that We're Not Going Back to Normal article was really, before anyone knew what was going on, was saying exactly what's happening now, which is that you're going to get wave after wave, measure after measure, until you're disciplined. And actually, one doesn't even know what one has to do to be disciplined and to make these measures go away.
Well, yes, that's true, Tony. And of course, certain countries like China, where Larry is based, they have not got any lockdown going on because they basically, through administrative means, got rid of the virus. So it's the countries which have not got rid of the virus which have then subjected to these ongoing, measures of control, and also compulsory or potentially compulsory vaccination and so on. So you've got all of these things going on. But the article is quite lengthy, and there's quite a lot of references in it, some of it more controversial and challenging than others, but certainly very interesting, because he's basically, I mean, what the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard said at the very beginning of this, because it was just after the assassination of Soleimani, is that we think we've been deliberately seeded with this because it looks as if it's all of our top people who are going down with it, which you wouldn't expect. Now, it may well be, in other words, that they are, those who are behind this are seeding further variants of COVID as we go along, because it's basically warfare, not psychological warfare, warfare. And in 2021, we're either going to have banking collapse, or we're quite likely to end up going to war, so and on a big scale.
I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The article all about the, well, it's actually a very detailed article by Larry Romanov, COVID-19 unexplained, really saying that much of what you've been told about COVID-19 is an absolute load of nonsense, so it needs unexplaining for you to understand actually what's really going on. I love articles like that, especially when Facebook bans them, because obviously they are part of the problem, Facebook, as we were hearing on Richard Lashar's programme this morning, actually on the BBC World Service. The Americans are struggling with these tech giants, saying that there isn't really any law to rein them back, because all of the antitrust laws are based around around finance, and these people offer their services for free, but they're now immensely powerful. Basically, what's happened is the tech giants have found a way around the US antitrust laws.
Well, so has the financial services sector. I mean, the antitrust laws are effectively, window dressing. Money talks. And that's all there is to it, really.
Okay, so the mysterious death, also we heard about this week, of the vaccine safety advocate Brandy Vaughan. This is a US story, which I just found absolutely amazing. Further articles on it, including a fundraising link for the investigation. The sudden death of the ex-pharmaceutical Republican representative Brandy Vaughan. COVID censorship with Scott Jensen. So what I'll do is I'll put a link up to that on our show page as well at thisweek.org.uk. The idea that somebody who's an expert might suddenly disappear is, I suppose, par for the course with all this stuff. Anyway, so the story itself is, and I'll put a link up to it on the show page, is one week ago, former pharmaceutical Merck representative Brandy Vaughan, founder of the non-profit LearnTheRisk.org, was found dead in her home. Her death was a sudden, suspicious, and currently being investigated by the authorities. What's drawn many people's attention in her death is she made a Facebook post towards the end of last year urging people to investigate her death if it happened and spread the word if she were to be found dead. Prior to that Facebook post, she put up a video on YouTube expressing how she had been harassed, experienced some weird things as she seemed to be quite shaken and worried. She said it was scary. She said that she requested journalists to cover the story if she passed away suddenly, but also requested that her close friends start a fundraiser to investigate her death. And then, Martin, she died. Amazingly enough, she says, "If someone would think what happened to me, it's foul play. You know exactly who and why, given my work and mission in this life. I'm not an accident prone. I get the highest health rating possible, and I went through a battery of medical tests a couple of years ago for my life insurance policy. If something were to happen to me, I've arranged for a close group of my friends to start a GoFundMe to hire a team of private investigators." Martin, these are people in the health industry just being threatened.
Well, I mean, I haven't looked into this case in particular, or I did notice something about it the other week. I mean, of course, what's his name, Michael Hastings, who was investigating the CIA, and then his car just accelerates to 95 miles an hour and crashes into a tree, because probably it was hacked by the, what we now know, the, you know, they're capable of hacking high-end cars and crashing them into things. People are assassinated by the deep state in the US and elsewhere. Martin Luther King was assassinated by the government. They have a Martin Luther King Day holiday, and everybody goes on about what a great guy he was, but there was a civil court case in Tennessee which concluded in front of a jury that he was definitely assassinated by the government. And so was John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. His father was assassinated by the government, and he, of course, is a big campaigner against big pharma and their vaccines.
Okay, so before we go completely off the subject, we have got actually gone off the subject of AIDS. I just thought it'd be interesting to look at back at the New Delhi University study that we covered back in the beginning of February, which seems to be so prescient, Martin. The this idea that it was, I think the article said something about stoking fuels of the COVID-19 being, or it was as it was at the time, SARS-CoV-2 being a bioweapon, because there seems to be a lot more emerging that it's got characteristics of AIDS. And one of the things that report was saying was that the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, which the genome had been published by the Chinese, the New Delhi University people were saying, well, actually, it's got a SARS spike protein on it and an AIDS one. Now, these are not normally, and wouldn't normally be carried around by coronaviruses, Martin, would they?
No, and I think when we're examining what you might call hardcore scientific evidence like this, it's necessary to always be careful and to use caveats.
One of the first things that David Icke said back in April was there is no virus, there is no such thing as COVID-19.
Well, the Chinese would disagree with that, because they basically isolated it almost immediately and then immediately told everybody what they'd found. And if you read the Larry Romanoff article, he will say that there have been some subsequent outbreaks in China, but they've not been of the original virus. They've been new, different viruses. And, of course, they are now basically on full biowarfare alert. And, of course, they were always prepared for biowarfare.
I mean,
we've
been inching towards war with China for a long time. John Pilger's documentary, The Coming War with China, which illustrates that.
Yes, well, Pompeo even spelt it out in words of one syllable the other week. We're no longer going to tolerate the Chinese Communist Party. Steve Bannon has made it absolutely clear.
Well, he just
clear.
Said China, didn't he?
Yeah.
It's the whole of the Chinese. Yes. So, you know, they're fair game.
I mean,
game
this has been coming
Pompeo.
For a while, because the Chinese government and society, at one stage they were quite happy to have the Chinese basically, you know, doing all of the crap work for the US multinationals, assembling iPhones, etc. But of course the Chinese aren't satisfied with just doing that. They're now moving into being very high tech.
Right, and at the beginning
more
of this,
high tech than the Yanks.
At the beginning
and
of this
at that
year
point, they've got to be cut down to size.
At the beginning of this year, when I was still on FM, when we were still on FM, well, there was an interview I did with a guy called Andreas Roxen, and he is a producer for the Swedish state broadcasting television people, who produced a 2-hour long, eventually ended up, apparently it cost, I don't know how much it cost, it took nearly 10 years to make, as I suppose all really good documentaries do, and it was called Cold Case Hammarskjöld. It was the investigation into the death of Dag Hammarskjöld, who was a Swedish guy. He was former
Norwegian, I think.
Was he?
I think he was Norwegian.
Anyway,
but he was the head of the UN.
I think he was. Anyway, okay. So, but he became the Secretary General of the United Nations, and he was around firefighting. So let's have a listen now to a bit from him, talking about the way that AIDS was used in South Africa.
SAIMR,
S-A-I-M-R. It's a funny word, but anyway, SAIMR. Some of the people involved in it were actually also injecting black Africans with a vaccine. They called it a vaccine, but actually they were injecting them with the AIDS virus. Now, this is an incredible allegation. Who was it told you that? And do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, first, the leader of the organization, his name was Keith Maxwell Annandale, and he was leaving a lot of documents behind, and some of these documents dealt with AIDS as a biological weapon, and in the context of killing off blacks to change the power, you know, power structure or the demographic structures in a way that would favor whites in South Africa. So that was only in writing. Then while we were researching, we also found out that this Maxwell, he was acting as a doctor, though he was not a doctor, and he was running clinics and laboratories in South Africa or Johannesburg suburbs. And we also talked to people who told that he was giving false injections at these clinics. And he was offering medical care at a very low cost. So, of course, that is very disturbing to have.
So, was he actually a medical doctor? Was he a medical doctor?
No, he was not. He did not have medical education whatsoever. That was, of course, very disturbing to have a person with that kind of mindset and knowing that he was, you know, injecting people. So that was the first. And then we were trying to talk to people, the people that admitted that they had been part of the organization, we tried these documents and to see, you know, what was this all about. And then we found a former member. He was the head of intelligence in SIMR, who told us that, yes, they were injecting people and in order to spread the HIV virus. We found a woman was killed in 1990 that was also a member of the organization, and she was working in the laboratories for SIMR. And she also, before she died, she told her family that the organization was smuggling contaminated viruses over the borders to Mozambique and Angola, and that was disturbing to her. And then she said that she feared for her life, and only a few weeks after she was killed, she had her throat cut off. So those were all sort of the information that pointed towards that this, at least they had the intention, that was very clear. And from these two persons, we got also the impression that it was not only intention, but that they set that in practice.
Now, one of the key questions that people listening will want to know is, were SIMR backed by the CIA, backed by MI6, Western Intelligence Services, or was it just a kind of rogue, racist South African organization, a kind of private army with no links to other countries in the West?
According to Alexander Jones, who participated in several operations, and according to him, there were financiers behind, and those were not South African. So before every operation, they had a briefing, and in these briefings, there was always a chair in the room for the financier. He never knew who they were, but he could tell from the dialect or the pronunciation that they were either French or British. So that points towards France and the UK. Then Susan Williams, the historian, she also has tried to, you know, figure out whether there may be a connection. And her, I would say, conclusion is that this is a British outfit, that it was... It was a military clandestine organization in the hands of British financial interests, sort of a private army for Brits with financial interests in Southern Africa.
Yeah, so that's Andreas Roxton, Martin, talking about AIDS. Pretty shocking to hear the idea that these Western... I mean, I think maybe it was what he said at the end there, that there were guys who were from financial interests in England who were sitting in on these meetings where they were arranging all these things like injecting black Africans with AIDS deliberately.
Well, as we said earlier, MI6 doesn't necessarily... you know, there's plenty of other, what you might call, they're not rogue outfits, but they just subcontract stuff out there. And, you know, that's quite clear. I mean, that was a TV show in Sweden. And, you know, that what they uncovered was that elements within the state in South Africa were deliberately infecting the population with AIDS. And of course, there's a bigger question about AIDS as a whole. Maybe it was created as a means of trying to reduce the population in Africa. And there's plenty of people in Africa who think that it was. But we've got to be very careful to be logical about the kind of things we say about all of this stuff and not jump too quickly.
The interesting thing about that story is there were rumours about this for decades. And it was really only the beginning of this year that there was hard and fast evidence from people actually involved.
Well, indeed. I mean, and it's not that surprising when you think about it. And, of course, Dag Hammarskjöld, who was a Norwegian, I believe, who was the head of the UN, he was assassinated by MI6 and the Americans. So because he was interfering in the Congo in ways they didn't like. So the idea that we're going to lose democracy if we don't wake up, it's like, when has there been democracy? The secret services in the West have been engaged in all of this stuff for decades.
Well, actually, he was Swedish. Ah, I was right for a change. Secretary General of the United Nations and an economist. Anyway, we're also joined, I think, I hope, on the line now by Harley Ford. Thanks for joining us. You're on a station somewhere. Whereabouts are you?
I'm currently stood outside Shrewsbury train station.
Fantastic. And as I understand, you were put on the train by the police earlier. What's happened? What's been going on today?
Well, I went out to do some shopping because obviously in the early hours of tomorrow morning, I'm supposed to be sailing off to Northern Ireland for Christmas. So I went out to do some last minute Christmas shopping in the galleries. Didn't have a mask on. I have an exemption card. Two of the wardens and two of the security guards came up to me and demanded I put a mask on. I told them I had an exemption. And next thing I know, the police were called. I was taken to a security office where I was arrested. The police did their usual checks. And because, obviously, of all the hoo-ha with the protests we've been doing, they kind of decided to go heavy-handed with me. They arrested me and took me to Paxway Police Station. Where I wasn't even put in a cell, I was immediately de-arrested and bailed to go back to answer questions and charges and possible charges on the 29th of December.
Well, that's quite convenient in a way, because it means that you couldn't come and sit here and be on this radio program.
But anyway, I told them that I was coming.
I guess they know these things. Who knows? I mean, personally walked through the galleries many times with no mask on or anything, and no one said anything to me.
I have cardiomyopathy in SPD, so I never, ever, ever wear a face mask. You know, I have one of the big blue badges and all that sort of stuff, so I never wear one.
Anyway, look, Harley, it would be lovely to hear from you a little bit about why you feel so strongly to get involved in Stand Up Bristol.
Yeah, well, it all started for me. I mean, you got to remember, back at the very beginning of all of this, I was actually very, very pro-government. I used to stand and clap for the NHS on a Thursday evening. I used to donate money to the NHS. I was pro-government. And then there was the Black Lives Matter protests. One of the things that was all over Facebook was apparently they were going to try and deface the cenotaph. Now, whether or not they were going to or not, I don't know, but quite a few of us ex-veterans turned up there just in case to protect the cenotaph. And I met a few people there, particularly Casey, and I got talking to them because I was there all day with them, and she started telling me, you know, because I was there with my face mask on and my gloves and all that sort of stuff, and she was telling me, look, you know what, this stuff really doesn't work, you know, and she started... She gave me loads of information to look at and loads of websites to go to. And it started from there. And the more I read and the more I found, the more I realized, you know what? It's Our government is quite literally lying to us.
Okay, so this is, you're talking about Casey Kendall here, who I think she's from Thornbury. She's been on this program talking about what she believes. But for you, though, what is it, number one, now that you are concerned about?
This vaccine. 100% this vaccine. This vaccine is dangerous. I'm seeing too many reports and seeing too many videos of people having the vaccines and collapsing and going into anaphylactic shock because of it and all that sort of stuff. I mean, there was a nurse who was vaccinated on live television, and literally 10 minutes later she collapsed, you know, in front of the cameras, you know. So, and the things they're putting in these vaccines, it's just, like, I cannot understand how they can sit there and say these vaccines are safe when they've been rushed through. And Pfizer.
Now, I know you're also a former serving soldier. Can you just tell us something about that, what you're allowed to say, you know, about your time in the army?
I served 25 years in Number 4 Rifles. I did tours of duty in Northern Ireland, Bosnia, Sierra Leone, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria. I saw a lot of duty. I mean, it was interesting what you were talking about earlier with the AIDS. When we were in Sierra Leone and we were going and we did some training in Africa, we were told don't mix with the locals because they've all been given AIDS.
Well, hang on, they've been given AIDS?
Yes.
That's not quite the same as they've caught AIDS, is it?
No. It was always don't mess with the locals because they've been given AIDS.
Amazing. So this does look as if the whole idea of using vaccines almost as a population reduction weapon is nothing new.
It's not. I mean, if you remember, like Nigeria, for instance, when I think it was Ebola Zaire. And they started doing vaccines to try and take the edge off that. The vaccines basically sterilised all the men. You know, I mean, it's the same. This is the same sort of people with the same sort of ideas as what was with Agent Orange and the DDT injections and testings. It's this idea of depopulation through vaccination is something that's been around for decades and decades and decades. This is not a new thing. This is just a new twist on it. It's now got to the point where they're also trying to do it in the mainstream world rather than just the third world.
Amazing.
Countries.
I mean, really Martin, you have also one thing I think maybe Harley and you will have in common is that you're quite concerned that there is a eugenics element to this. What's going on? I mean, of course, it's a global problem now, isn't it? It's a global policy, basically.
Bill Gates at one stage was pushing his vaccine agenda, and of course he's got no medical background at all. And he was saying if we can vaccinate developing countries, we can probably reduce population by up to 10 or 15%. And I think, hang on a minute, this doesn't compute. I mean, vaccination isn't there to reduce the population. But in his mind, it is. And I think that's very revealing that he's going to say something like that.
It is. I mean, I agree with that completely. But for me, it'd be, how would he do it? Are we talking about sterilisation, or are we talking about just dodgy injections that's going to kill people? That's my fear. I mean, since I left the forces, I've become a very devout Christian, and my fear is that these vaccinations are literally the mark of the beast. You know, I mean, I've seen reports about the alleged God code that this vaccine kills. There's people that have had the vaccines. They've said since they've had the vaccines, they can't feel God. They can't feel the spirits. They can't feel spiritual energy at all.
I mean, that's surely very speculative. The idea that by having a vaccine, it's going to change the way you think.
It is, but they did actually. I mean, depending on what your viewpoint is, there is a small section of your DNA that they call the God code, and that is the part that kind of opens you up to spirituality. And apparently this vaccine nullifies that code.
Well, I think we need to do some proper experiments on that. That'd be very interesting to get maybe people who are devout God believers in care homes after they've had the vaccine and then maybe interview them. You know,
yeah, I think that would be good.
There's no reason why that ideas like that, shall we? I'm afraid to say, Harley, conspiracy theories like that can't actually be put to the test. I think exactly. What you often hear is a conspiracy theory, you've just got to throw it in the bin. No, I think, you know, most of the time, if it's got any credibility to it at all, and I certainly think we're involved in a spiritual battle. One of the spiritual battles at the moment seems to be between the lateral flow test and the PCR test. There's a battle going on. The lateral flow test gives you a pretty good indication of whether you've actually got COVID-19, whereas the PCR test, all that will do is it will tell you if you've had it over the last 6 or 8 months. And, of course, many people are testing positive for something that they've dealt with and had a long time ago. But the thing about AIDS, we were talking about AIDS there, Holly, is that potentially AIDS is something that can stay with you for life. It can create a kind of autoimmune disease where it gets into your cells and it's kind of hanging around in your body forever.
And it's also transferable, you know. So if you're looking at the possibility that the AIDS virus was man-made and it's a man-made weapon, it would be the perfect weapon, because it's something you infect someone with, and then you just release that person, and every time they have unprotected sex with someone, they infect them.
What about ways forward? Because obviously you've decided to put your shoulder to the rugby scrum when it comes to trying to shift the ground. I mean, it's been quite good this week, and we'll be hearing a clip from this later, hearing the debate in Westminster Hall, talking about never mandating vaccines and also making sure that there is no punitive measures taken against people who decide not to take the vaccine. Well, that was really good to hear. But what do you think are the ways forward? Because I know you're a bit of a strategist, aren't you?
Yes, I am, yeah. My outlook is that I would really like to see it campaigned for, that the vaccine is not mandatory. I mean, the minute they start throwing the words mandatory vaccination out, then you're talking about them basically doing away with human rights. It's your right to refuse medical treatment and medical intervention. You know, I'm not sure what law it is, but I'm sure I can remember something in the, I think it's the Geneva Code or international law that states that you cannot be forced to have medical treatment, nor can he be penalised for refusing medical treatment. So surely a vaccine must fall under the heading of medical treatment.
No, but I mean, it's basically what's happening now is a kind of hard sell, isn't it? I mean, we're seeing these, Matt Hancock virtually weeping on live television as the first vaccine is injected into a little old lady. The idea is that, you know, if you're not doing this, then you're letting your country down.
Yeah, and I think that's unfair. I really do. I mean, some of these things that they're doing. I mean, there's schools out there that are being, where the children are being told, you know what, it is actually okay to keep secrets from mummy and daddy, and having a vaccine to protect your nan and granddad is a good secret to keep.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
That's literally breaking down the foundations of a family.
So where do you think this is? Okay, look, this is. I know you're going to have to go and catch your train in a minute, but where do you think? We've got two questions to ask you finally, Harley. The first one is where do you think this is heading? Where are we going to be in a year's time?
The optimist side of me says that in a year's time, our government's going to have woken up and realise, you know what? A majority of people don't actually want to be forced to have this needle stuck in them. A majority of people don't believe that they have to have this injection just to get into heaven. You know, that's what I'd like to think. I'd like to think that's going to happen, but I honestly don't think that's what's going to happen. I think that too many people are going to blindly comply and put their faith in a vaccine that isn't properly tested. It hasn't been rigorously tested like the other vaccines that we subject our children to, that have been rigorously tested over decades. This one hasn't. It's impossible for it to have been had, because it's only been created on the fly in the last 8 months. You know, so I would like to see the vaccinations withdrawn fully and more testing done. I mean, I'm not a COVID denier. At no point will I say that there is no such thing as coronavirus, because I know there is, because I've had it. You know, I also know...
Harley, can you just take us through, you know, what it was like for you? Was it, did you get it badly, a little bit? How did you know?
I started getting a temperature on, let's just say, for argument's sake, the Monday. I started getting a high temperature on the Monday. By Tuesday, my throat felt like it had sandpaper rubbed inside it. By the end of the day Tuesday, I was coughing and spluttering all the time. Every time I tried to have a cigarette, I was coughing the guts up. Every time I tried to drink anything hot, I was coughing. Within 2 days after that, I could barely move because I was just literally aching from head to foot. I mean, even my hair was aching. That's how much it was aching. Just getting up to go to the toilet would have me panting. It would put my heart rate up in the 150s, 160s range. I have a heart condition, and so I was quite concerned. I'll be honest, I was quite concerned, thinking, shit, I'm probably going to have to go to the hospital for this, you know?
What month?
That was beginning of October.
Right, only recently,
Yeah, and it was gone by itself within about 8 days. And literally, I didn't do anything special. All I did was took paracetamol to keep the temperature down and drank loads of orange juice. That was it. That was literally all I did.
Were you a COVID denier before you got the disease?
Yes.
Okay. So
yes.
That was a bit of a lesson, wasn't it?
Yeah. One thing with me is I am quite I'm quite an honest guy. So yeah, I believe that the COVID was just a load of rubbish and it was just a smokescreen. Until I got ill, and obviously my key worker, my support worker, arranged for me to be given various blood tests and whatnot. It came back that I was positive for COVID. I'll be honest, I panicked. I was proper scared. I'll be completely honest. I was proper scared. I was thinking, my God, I'm going to end up in hospital. I'm going to end up on a ventilator. I'm going to end up dying and all that sort of stuff. 8 days, I was better again. I mean, one thing I will say is this illness does play tricks on your mind. It makes you think you're dying. It really does. You literally, when this illness kicks in, you really do think that you're dying. You feel really bad. It feels difficult to breathe, and you think, my God, I'm going to die any minute now. Every breath I take is going to be my last breath, you know? But once you, it's kind of like, it's almost like the power of positive thinking. And once you say to yourself, no, I'm not going to let this beat me. I'm going to beat this. I'm going to beat this instead. And you start downing the paracetamol and the zinc tablets or the vitamin tablets and whatnot. It clears up quite quick. I mean, I was ill as hell for about 3 days, and then when I started on the paracetamol and orange juice, within another 3 or 4 days, it was gone, and I was back on my feet again.
Okay, well, look, Harley, final question is, who's behind all this, and what's the real agenda?
No, that's actually a difficult one. It really is, because obviously, like you guys, I've heard all the theories, both conspiracy theories and possible theories and wild accusational theories.
But look, I mean, listen, you're a good lad. You've gone through all that and you've thrown all the rubbish in the bin. What are you left with?
Bill Gates.
So what is Bill Gates' agenda?
I think he's still pushing the agenda he tried to push years ago when he was talking about depopulation through vaccination.
Yeah.
I really do think that. I mean, he's throwing so much into this. I mean, He's not medically trained. He's throwing so much into this, into pushing these vaccines, and there's no reason for him to do so. The only reason for him to do so is to push an agenda, and the only agenda I know of that he could be pushing is going to be depopulation. It's because that's what he's been pushing for years.
Okay, anyway, listen, Harley Ford, fascinating to chat to you from Stand Up Bristol, heading back to Northern Ireland as we speak. Probably that's your train, I think I can hear in the background there, Harley.
Yep, it's coming in soon.
Bless you, thanks very much for chatting, and speak to you again. Hopefully, when you're back in Bristol, you'll be able to actually sit down here, and your bail conditions are a little bit different. We can sit you down and have a proper chat.
That'd be fantastic. I look forward to it, Tony. Thank you for having me on the show, and thank you for listening to me.
Thanks very much, Harley Ford. You heard, live from... a railway station. Can you remember where it was? Shrewsbury Railway Station. So Martin heard quite a lot there. Harley actually having COVID himself, but also being decent enough to fess up and say, well, I was a COVID denier. Obviously, then I caught it. I'm not anymore. But he's pointing the finger at Bill Gates. Do you think he's right to do that?
Well, Bill Gates is clearly a big player, but he won't be the only one. You know, it's not...
The biggie with Gates, though, I mean, sorry, but the biggie with Gates is he's been involved in this whole thing, Event 201. He was also involved in this Agenda 20, ID 2020 thing, which is about the vaccine passports. He's been pushing this stuff actually for decades behind the scenes, and this is his big moment. He sees it. He's left the board of Microsoft. He's nothing to do. Well, he's got shares still in Microsoft, but now he's decided to set out on this great mission to convert the world to his vaccines.
Yeah, but you've also got to remember that he's got massive investments in the biotechnology companies which are supplying the vaccines. So the idea that he's a philanthropist is simply wrong. He uses his bully pulpit to push his ideology. But, of course, he is actually well-placed to make a load of money out of it. And, of course, Pfizer have been given indemnity. So any reactions to the vaccine, and it looks as if there are quite a lot of reactions to this vaccine, and then they cannot sue Pfizer because governments have given... basically said that the governments have put themselves on the hook. So, you know, in Britain, it's the British taxpayer who will have to pay out if Pfizer vaccines turn out to be dangerous. Now, Bill Gates is an important...
Actually, Adam Scarborough was talking about that too, wasn't he?
Yeah.
The mental health nurse saying this indemnification is like a smoking gun. The idea that they're going to stick all this stuff in you and then they're saying, oh, well, if anything goes wrong, I go and talk to the government over there. It's their
fault. Well, I mean, as you know, we've had you've had clips of Bill Gates saying that you'd have thought that if the private sector was such a brilliant setup and they'd come up with a vaccine, that they would be perfectly happy to sell that vaccine and also to run the risk of it not working and then therefore be sued. But in actual fact, of course, because the public health system depends upon the government, it's not actually a private sector setup. But of course, Gates, in the clip that you used some while ago, was saying, well, the public sector can provide all the funding, but it's the private sector that's going to provide the expertise. And you feel like saying, no, if it's the private sector are confident of the expertise, they don't need government funding.
Yeah,
and of course, if you need
parasites.
Government funding,
then
you're not the private sector.
These people are parasites. Let me say, parasites. Bill Gates, parasite. John D. Rockefeller, parasite. What he did with his monopolistic practices in the oil industry, John D. Rockefeller, Bill Gates has done exactly the same thing with Microsoft.
Yes, but of course what you've also got is vaccines being developed, for example, in Cuba, which are not being developed for private profit. And of course they're not rushing out with them because they're taking their time. And ultimately, if they're successful, they will be knocked out to the developing world for free.
Okay, so there's also quite a lot of green fascists who are behind this depopulation agenda, saying, oh, we've got too many people, we need to get rid of them. The Bill Gates, in a weird way, fits in with them. So let's have a listen to Gates now, talking about what he thinks are the worries about population growth, rather sort of triggered there by Harley Ford, who is speaking to us from Stand Up Bristol.
Well, the population growth issue at the global level, it's not that daunting. That is, the population percentage-wise is growing slower today than in the past, and so it will actually peak out. The problem is that the population is growing the fastest where people are less able to deal with it. So it's in the very poorest places that you're going to have a tripling in population by 2050. And so their ability to feed, educate, provide jobs, stability, protect the environment in those locations mean they're faced with an almost impossible problem. Northern Nigeria, Yemen, Chad. And so what we need to do is take this aid generosity and this innovation and go into those places, offer the women better tools where they want to space birthing or have a smaller family size, and improve health, because it's amazingly, as children survive, parents feel like they'll have enough kids to support them in their old age, and so they choose to have less children. Niger right now, it's still 7 children per family, whereas in the richer countries, you're often at a stable point of which is 2.1 or even less. And so it's really an acute problem in a certain number of places, and we've got to make sure that we help out with the tools now so that they don't have an impossible situation later.
Yeah, so that's Bill Gates there. He wants to help out. He has been helping out, Martin, with his vaccine programs that have killed thousands and maimed tens of thousands of children.
Yeah, well, you've got, I mean, he's accused of pushing vaccines which are dangerous and are trying to control population. But what he's doing there is he's making what is a straightforward case for trying to control population. I mean, there's nothing there, ostensibly, which you could argue with in a reasonable way.
Do you think so? I would argue.
Well, no.
Straight away, I will argue. He's saying that it's the poorer countries where the population growth is too high. Well, there's a very good reason for that, and that's because the rich countries are screwing them.
Yes. And of course,
so if the rich countries just stop screwing these poor countries, people wouldn't go for having to have loads of kids in order to survive in their old age.
Well, I've just been reading all about this stuff not that long ago. There is actually quite clearly a demographic transition taking place in countries. For example, China used to have big families. They don't anymore. And the problem they're going to have is they probably haven't got enough young people coming into the workforce to carry on paying the pensions of the people who are older. And that's an issue in Japan as well, because their population is definitely shrinking. And what you've got in Japan, which is a relatively wealthy country, is because they won't allow immigrants into the country because of their cultural preferences. You've then got what effectively happens is that highly trained women, you know, who are very highly skilled, are basically retiring in mid-career because they've got to look after elderly parents and so on. And, there are issues around demography all over the world. The continent where you've still got a massively rising population is in Africa. And, of course, that's because the development in Africa, as you rightly point out, has been ultimately destroyed, for example, by the lost 1980s and structural adjustment programs of the IMF, which people used to call severe suffering for African people, structural adjustment program, SAP. And ultimately, Africa has been the most exploited continent, and that's why they've got the most problems to resolve.
Well, AIDS has been our little theme, actually, hasn't it, this evening? You know, linking COVID to AIDS, well, it's obvious. You find a really nasty disease. You find, if you're an evil Dr. Evil with his needle, bio-warfare person, what you'll do is you'll find something incredibly contagious like the coronavirus, and you'll stick one of the most hideous things ever known to man, possibly even man-made itself, the AIDS virus, onto it.
That the bit of the virus that's stuck onto it is the bit that makes it infectious, not the bit, you know, not necessarily the bit that kills you.
My point I'm trying to make here is that this is evidence, folks, that this has been foisted on humanity deliberately, and it's the one thing it seems that nobody in the West wants to talk about, because, Martin, it may actually, you know, come back to Portendown, it may come back to Fort Detrick, it may come back to the Pentagon.
Well, what's in Romanoff's article, he points out that they've got all the different strains of COVID-19 in the US. And Fort Detrick, which is, you know, the source of the anthrax that was used in the attacks after 9/11, which then led to the passing of the Patriot Act, definitely sourced at Fort Detrick. And Fort Detrick was closed down in June and July of last year. Then in September, the banking system collapsed, but secretly bailed out. And BlackRock basically took over the Federal Reserve and the US Treasury. And then in November, we know that the Israeli Defense Forces were warned by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. Now, what Romanoff is suggesting is that there may have been an accidental leak from Fort Detrick. And don't forget, the Bulgarian journalist is very good, the woman journalist who uncovered the rat lines supplying weaponry to jihadis in Syria. She's also done a lot of very good work on biological warfare laboratories in Georgia and other former Soviet countries. And at one stage, the US was definitely trying to find people who were genetically Russian and genetically Chinese, and they wanted to take samples of their blood. And eventually they were all kicked out of both Russia and China. Now, in other words, it's pretty clear that the Western deep state has been carrying on all sorts of basically what should be illegal investigations into biological and chemical warfare, which is why, of course, they accuse Saddam Hussein of being having weapons of mass destruction, etc. It's classic projection. We're accusing other people of doing what you're doing. And they took over loads and loads of research into biological and chemical weapons from the Japanese Kempeitai at the end of the war. And the Kempeitai people who'd done it all were all given a pardon. And all of the material, which had been developed by injecting people with sarin, etc., was then handed over to the US military. And, of course, that's what they do. That's what they've been doing all along.
Okay, so I want to go back now to June of this year, when a chap called Professor Adrian Hayday at King's College, and this was on the BBC World Service. I mean, this is the sort of thing that you will never get on BBC Network anywhere because it's censored by the BBC because it doesn't fit in with their whole agenda of making sure people don't actually understand what's going on. They just do as they're told. And this is where we hear Professor Adrian Hayday at King's College, the Francis Crick Institute, talking about his evidence that linking COVID, finding that the COVID virus has got characteristics of AIDS virus too.
At the beginning of the pandemic, it looked like COVID-19 was a respiratory illness. Now we know it can also affect other organs, and it appears it can also short-circuit the immune system, working in a way that's similar to HIV. I've been speaking to Dr. Adrian Hayday, a group leader at the Francis Crick Institute and Professor of Immunobiology at King's College London.
The surprising thing is that there are huge losses of T cells, which are lymphocytes, which are extremely important in protecting us against pathogens, that we see in COVID-19 that are reminiscent to some extent in HIV. And what's extraordinary is that HIV achieves this by directly infecting the T cells and dysregulating or reorganizing the T-cell compartment, whereas there's no evidence that the COVID virus does this. It seems to do it by some as yet unknown mechanism indirectly. And you see in post-mortem analyses, necrotic areas where you would normally have T-cells, very similar to what you used to see on AIDS patient post-mortems.
Given what you've said, what are the implications then for not just treatments, but long-term recuperation, let alone vaccines?
The good news is that the immune system is usually incredibly good at bouncing back. So while there will, of course, be all sorts of appropriate downstream studies of individuals who've been through COVID-19 disease and have required hospitalization, I don't think there's any reason at this point to be concerned of long-term consequences. In the shorter term, we definitely are in a situation where a whole set of individuals, that is, these individuals who seem to require hospitalization, do seem to have been disabled for one part of their protective response. So our response in turn to that comes in multiple ways. One is to boost T cell responses. And the other is, of course, as we go forward and think about improving vaccine designs, making sure that we consider that these individuals may be needing more support for their T cell compartment.
Do you know enough now to say that some of the treatments will involve the kind of antiretroviral drugs that are successful to treat HIV patients?
Antiretrovirals used in HIV will have their equivalents for coronavirus. The basic research that has gone into detailed understanding of what people's immune systems look like in this disease is moving us from a place where we had general ideas to now where we've got some very specific ideas. And that always helps you in the design of improved treatment. So I'm very optimistic that this disease will get more manageable. And that's critical to reducing the global threat that the virus poses.
Optimistic news from Dr. Adrian Hayday, group leader at the Francis Crick Institute and a professor at King's College London.
So interesting, more and more evidence piling up that there's something. I mean, the question is always going to be whether it was natural or not. My guess is not natural. It doesn't look as if there's anything natural about this thing at all.
Well, I mean, what he was saying there is that it doesn't function like, it has the same effect as HIV, but it doesn't function like HIV. But there's also an Indian study which shows that elements within the virus look as if they're from HIV. Yeah. Now, this is very murky, and I'm not really willing to sort of stake too much on this, because it's beyond my level of competence. But I think that biological warfare is definitely a thing. It definitely is out there, and it's definitely been used in the past.
Well, you know what, this rather reminds me of the disappearance of MH370, I think, wasn't it? The one that was heading from Kuala Lumpur up to Beijing. And that became a mystery for only one reason, and that was because it was a military thing. The information about what had happened to it was covered by military protocols, and the press simply weren't allowed to report it. Simple as that. So I would say that's what's going on here. We've got the press not reporting what's going on with COVID-19 because the military are weighing down on this.
Well,
they don't do that in public, by the way. You won't see some army officer on Newsnight saying, "Oh, you're not allowed to talk about this."
Well, look, the way in which the grand Wurlitzer of propaganda in the West works is quite sophisticated. You know, there's not just one thing going on. There's more than one thing going on usually. But I think it's pretty clear that from what Romanoff is saying, I think the Chinese have concluded that this is a biological warfare attack, and that's why they've adopted the measures they've adopted.
Yeah, you've already said that. Anyway, from Ontario this week, one of the most fascinating little clips I saw was again, it's another one from Canada, like we had the Canadian Army officer on earlier on. In Ontario, there was some doctors came onto the television who were public health doctors. And amazingly, well, somebody left the microphones on while they weren't actually on the air and caught them talking about reading a script. So they were saying basically, oh, well, it's not really us we're not talking off the top of our heads. We're not just sharing with the audience as Martin and Tony do on a Friday evening. What they're doing is they're just reading a script. Anyway, I thought it was quite interesting to hear them confess that when you're asking them questions, they're just reading from scripts. So let's have a listen to that now. And I've just repeated it. So if you don't get it clearly the first time, it's only short, just about 15 seconds or so. And you'll hear one of these doctors just explaining that that's what they do. They're script readers. They're kind of Hollywood, really.
I don't know why I bring all these papers. I never look at them. I just say whatever they write down for me.
That's why.
I don't know why I bring all these papers. I never look at them. I just say whatever they write down for me.
That's why.
And there she is, just about to go on live TV, Martin. I just say whatever it is they write down for me. I mean, she's just there as an actress, really. She's not a proper public health spokesperson.
Well, the way this is being, the way that this is being justified is that in a public health emergency, you very much need to have a clear message about what people should and shouldn't do. And therefore the government, the British government, for example, has employed public relations consultants, like the woman who's in charge of the vaccine programme. I've forgotten her name, but she's married to a Tory MP. She spent £600,000.
Dido, is it?
No, it's a different one. But she's in charge of the vaccines, not of the testing. I've forgotten her name, but she's married to a Tory MP. But anyway, she spent we were talking about the contracts that are given out. £600,000 was spent on a public relations firm to explain how we're going to get people to take the vaccines and so on. So the way it's justified is that because you've got a public health emergency, you need to have a professional public relations firm to make sure that your messaging is as it should be if you want to get certain results.
It sounds to me a little bit like the government.
I'm being devil's advocate there about how they claim that this is, and that's what this woman is saying.
Right.
I'm just saying what they tell me to say.
It's a bit like
because we've got to keep a message simple and everybody's got to understand
the government
it and so on.
Spending all that money on promoting Remain. The government did, as the government did in 2016 in the referendum campaign. The government shouldn't really be doing this. You should just let people say whatever it is they want to say and keep out of it rather than spending public money on trying to promote one side or the other side of a debate. Anyway, this week I spoke to retired dentist Sharon Lawrence, who's from Oxford, or that area anyway, somewhere around there. I met her in Oxford, actually. Where she was saying, I thought some fascinating stuff, particularly about what exactly is this new mRNA Pfizer vaccine?
Well, it's completely different to what they've ever developed previously as vaccines. Vaccines not normally work by sort of a biological process, and it's actually some sort of part of the virus or inactivated virus which actually exists, or like a toxoid from the virus, but something biological, and then the person's effectively inoculated with it when they should be in a healthy state to develop immunity. But this doesn't work like that at all. It's a completely new process, and they've never used it on people before, so they've got absolutely no idea what the long-term effects will be, because they've only tried it for like a few weeks or months. There's no way they can know what's going to happen to those people in a couple of years or even 6 months, because they haven't tried it for long enough. And they didn't even really do the animal tests with the vaccines. So it seems to have missed out a lot of stages, and there's no way they can know what the long-term effects are, because they've just not studied it for long enough.
Yeah, so that was Sharon Lawrence talking about the lack of testing of the mRNA Pfizer vaccine, something which we repeat on here week after week after week. Everyone needs to know how little this has been tested, and inform your loved ones, because then they're not really talking about this at all on national TV or anywhere like that. They're trying to do the hard sell. Sharon also talked to me about the global burden of disease, because this is a survey that was done recently to look at what was actually killing people. It certainly wasn't COVID-19.
It was actually a big global burden of disease study a few years ago. The leading cause of death globally is probably actually poor nutrition and lack of food. And one in five of all deaths are linked to poor nutrition and lack of food, including the Western diet or not enough food. So that's actually the big thing. And even the people who are most susceptible to the so-called COVID are the people who've got things like diabetes and heart disease and high blood pressure. And all those are really strongly linked to poor diet and lifestyle anyway. And also they're not now finding the thing which most strongly mitigates the disease, COVID-19, is vitamin D. So they should be looking at diet and lifestyle, not locking people up.
And then Sharon was also talking to me about a petition which Dr. Mike Eden has been putting together and is out there, and you can sign it if you like. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And also the potential damaging effects of the, talking about the eugenics as we were about Bill Gates just a little while ago, on your fertility of this Pfizer mRNA vaccine.
I think they've actually petitioned the European Medicines Agency. So that's the agency that should be approving it EU-wide, approving the vaccine. So they've petitioned to stop the phase three trials, because those are actually still ongoing, and they should be collecting data still for the next two years, because they haven't really got all the data for the vaccines yet. I think it's about a 40-page document they sent to the European Medicines Agency. And one of the things they put in it, they were very concerned about possible effects on fertility, because the messenger RNA vaccines are designed to make your body attack the spike protein. So the spike protein is part of the coronavirus, but they also, as far as they know, obviously they're from their science, they say this, the same sort of spike protein exists in the placenta. So a possible danger of the vaccine is it could make a woman's body attack the placenta. But they obviously haven't tried the vaccine for long enough to know if that would happen. And all the women who took part in the trial needed to be taking contraception, and to take it for 2 months after they received the trial vaccine. So at this point, they have no idea if the vaccine had any effect on fertility. And it actually says in the Medicines Agency statement about the vaccine release, it actually says that they don't know the effect on fertility.
So no, they don't know the effect of fertility. Well, maybe somebody does, and they're not telling. Sharon's basic mission, Martin, since she's gotten involved with this, is to be compiling medical reports to circulate round to people like the World Doctors Alliance and other people like that. She's now working for them, doing compilations of, and not just off the internet, all sorts of libraries and things like that, getting studies into various aspects of viruses, particularly this virus, and making them available as much as she can to the people who are, the doctors who are campaigning. I suppose that's the most extraordinary thing about this. I mean, back with 9/11, we had architects and engineers that took a sort of 5, 6, or 8 years to get together and form an organisation. We've now pretty much straight off the starting blocks got a whole load of doctors fighting the policy of the Bill Gates vaccine rollout and these very strict measures around the country and around the world.
I think you've got to separate the strict measures from the vaccines. The Chinese have adopted strict measures and they've been very successful in adopting those measures, but they're not having a Pfizer vaccine. Can I just make the point about the Pfizer vaccine as well? It costs $36 a shot. The AstraZeneca shot, if it comes through, will be $2 or $3 a shot.
Okay, but
so what we're dealing with here is profiteering.
As
well as everything else.
Definitely, money stinks all over this story. And the most important, I think, is the way the hedge funds have been pushing money into Pfizer and other companies, Moderna particularly, who's never produced anything for market at all. The whole of Moderna is a fiction based on the diseased minds of the hedge funds who are shoving money into them. And the only reason they're shoving money into places like Moderna is because they are promising to get vaccines to market earlier. They're not promising anything to do with safety, and they don't need to, Martin, because they can go back to the hedge funds and say, oh, we don't have to worry about safety because it's all covered by the government.
Yeah, well, if you remember some months ago, there was stuff in the British press about how the Russian cyber warfare teams were trying to hack into the AstraZeneca Oxford databases to try and steal what they were doing. And the Russian response to that was, we're not doing that because we're actually working with those teams. We've given them our stuff that we've developed and we're actually cooperating with them. And so that was a load of nonsense. And what should be happening, and this is another issue which we haven't really covered, is that there shouldn't be any profiteering on the back of making these vaccines. And some countries are basically sharing everything that they've developed as quickly as they develop it.
In a way, shareholders are going to have a lot of things to say about that, Martin. Shareholders have invested a lot of money.
Well, indeed, and of course the point about Big Pharma in the West is that it is totally corrupt. But that doesn't mean that there's not that developing a vaccine isn't a legitimate goal.
I mean, what you're implying here is that there's actually a bigger battle going on about how humanity does stuff, whether it does it based on profit or whether it does it based on need.
That's right. And of course, the developing countries for years have been trying to chip away at Big Pharma in the West patent. It's what they call trade-related trips and trims. I've forgotten what they actually stand for. But the point is that the patents of Big Pharma mean that, you know, we do have quite good drugs for dealing with things like malaria, for example. And what developing countries like Bangladesh want is to be able to knock out anti-malarial drugs at cost. But they're not
trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights.
Yes. Yeah. That's
WTO.
Yes, the WTO, which of course you don't have to be part of because the Chinese weren't at one stage. And of course, what the developing world wants is for very weak patent protection so that they can quickly adopt necessary medicines to deal with basic problems. And of course, a lot of the basic medicines that they need are of actual fact have been around for ages, and they could produce them very cheaply
on our diet,
but they're
show,
not allowed to because it's to do with making money for Western pharmaceutical companies.
On our dialect show, I remember chatting to a fascinating guy years ago. He was talking about patent protection and how you do it. You've got to actually keep the information secret somehow. You publish some basic stuff, but you don't tell everyone how to do it exactly. And you have to do that by putting things in a cage, because if you put it on a computer, someone might get into your computer.
Yeah, but even if you know what to do, you're not allowed to do it because the patent protection means that you have to pay a royalty to the company which developed it in the first place. Now, the obvious point, if you look at the way the world healthcare system functions, all of the research is actually geared towards the diseases of the wealthy. That's where the money is spent. And of course,
hang on. Bill Gates says the opposite. He says, I spend money elsewhere. I spend it on malaria, things like
yes,
this.
Yes, but what he's doing is they're then saying, we are going to, the people who've caused the problem, the distortions in the international system, then say, we're the solution. We're perhaps coming on to discuss the Great Reset in a minute. That's exactly what that is.
Okay.
It's saying, but the people who are the cause of the problems then say, we're the solution.
Okay, well, there's
but of course, there is an alternative way of doing things in Russia, in China, and in Cuba.
And in Venezuela. And anyway, so I thought we'd have a listen to, this is about seven or so minutes long, and it's an extract from a debate which happened this week on Monday at Westminster Hall. It's one of those things where you sign a petition online, and so the MPs have to actually go and debate it, and which is what they did on Monday. And it's about an e-petition relating to vaccination for COVID-19, which took place on Monday. It's Steve Baker from the Tories and another MP who's also announced halfway through. But you'll hear a little bit from both of them here talking about, I think, absolutely fascinating subjects. So I'd love to have seen a bit more coverage of this, which is about mandating vaccines and then also whether or not people are going to have some sort of vaccine passport in order to go back to the pub, go and fly around the world, that sort of thing.
So you could imagine a circumstance where, for example, an airline chose to say to people, you may not have a flight until you've had a vaccine. A restaurant might say you can't come in until you've had the vaccine. And so on and on it would go, until you get to a point that unless people have had the vaccine, they can't live what most of us would consider a normal life, going to restaurants, shops, whatever it may be. And that, to me, would be totally unacceptable. But also, before I come on to why it'd be unacceptable, it also, I have to say, I think would be ineffective. There's a difference between a vaccine stopping you getting the disease, being killed by the disease, and a vaccine stopping you shedding the disease onto others. So, of course, the harm principle in the philosophy of freedom is about constraining people's liberties so that they don't harm others. And that means there's a really profound practical difference between the purpose of a vaccine stopping you getting sick yourself and the purpose of a vaccine stopping you shedding it. And I think at the moment a number of businesses looking at restricting their customers to those who've been vaccinated haven't understood that actually we don't yet know whether the vaccine will stop people shedding the disease. So I turn to something the Secretary of State for Health said in relation to the Pfizer vaccine. He was asked how many people would need to be vaccinated before life could return to normal. And he said, the answer to that is we just don't know. The trials can tell you if a vaccine is clinically safe and if it's effective at protecting an individual from the disease. What we can't know until we've vaccinated a significant proportion of the population is how much it stops the transmission of the disease. So that's really the first point. As I would say to businesses, large and small, please don't start seeking to restrict your customers' ability to come and do business with you because they haven't had the vaccine. It's not an effective strategy. The Secretary of State has explained why. But also then I want to come on to what I think is the moral case, because there are those who argue that property rights should be so strong that property owners should be allowed to serve whoever they wish. But that is, of course, not the approach we take in an enlightened and modern civilised society. And I'm afraid the argument does touch on some very difficult issues. We don't, for example, recently have seen it, we don't allow people to say that they won't have same-sex couples in their bed and breakfast. You know, we won't allow discrimination against the range of protected characteristics. So I can see that ministers might face a temptation to say, let's allow the acceleration of the rollout of the vaccine by perhaps turning a blind eye to property owners insisting on people being vaccinated to go and stay in the bed and breakfast or whatever it might be. But the problem I think ministers have on that basis, and I can see that some ministers might argue on the basis of property rights that shop owners, hotel owners and so on ought to have the choice. Unfortunately, and I do understand the argument because I'm a classical liberal and I think about property rights, but I have to say to my honourable friend, and I'm sure he understands this argument, I think we cross a Rubicon if we say you can discriminate against people on the basis of their health status. And I think that would be a very sad and wrong basis to go forward as a country, even though I can understand that in the face of this disease, with all that that implies, the pressure on ministers, on officials, on members of the public, the extreme pressure on businesses, goodness knows, we all know what the costs are. It would be very easy to make an ethical mistake, which I think we could regret for a very long time. So for those two reasons, because it's not an effective thing to do, and because I think it's a morally wrong thing to do, to discriminate against people on the basis of their choice not to take a vaccine, I will stand with the petitioners in this sentiment in saying that they want the government to prevent any restrictions being placed on those who refuse to have any potential COVID-19 vaccine. Of course it's a very serious disease. Of course we should all take the vaccine. I absolutely stand with my honourable friends who went before me in supporting vaccination. I won't give the least sucker to the anti-vaxxers, but I will just say to my honourable friend, people have all sorts of strange beliefs in this world. And if people don't want to take a vaccine, please, please, let's not turn a blind eye to any kind of discrimination against them. Thank you.
Tricia Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very pleased to participate in this debate today about the COVID vaccine, and I thank the member for Kirkshalton and Wallington for his comprehensive exposition of the matter before us today. Every government must, in the face of a pandemic, in the face of any threat to public safety, disease, have at its forefront the safety of its people. And that must be the overriding and principal concern. And the public, who on the whole have been extremely compliant with regards to restrictions, will overwhelmingly, I believe, and collectively be breathing a sigh of relief that we now have a vaccine which will help to end or begin to see the end of these terrible days, not just to allow us to resume some kind of normality, but which will save lives. And we in particular, of course, are bearing in mind the lives of our older people who are particularly vulnerable to this terrible disease. Now, I'm not going to be philosophical, Mr. Chair, because my personal view, and maybe I'm just an eternal optimist, but my personal view is that judging from the high levels of public compliance with public health measures, which we've all found very difficult, but despite that, there has been overwhelming public compliance. I believe, by the same token, the take-up of this vaccine will be very high indeed. Of course, individuals can choose, if they so wish, to refuse the vaccine. But I honestly believe that the overwhelming majority will have the vaccine, just as the overwhelming majority of those eligible take advantage of the flu vaccine. Just as those parents ensure that the rotavirus vaccine is administered to their children, that the vaccine to protect their children against diphtheria is taken up, the vaccine to protect them against hepatitis B, to protect them against haemophilus influenza, to protect them against polio, to protect them against tetanus, and to protect them against whooping cough. Such vaccinations are given to children. That list that I have just read out, those are the vaccinations given to children in the first 16 weeks of their lives, when they are at their most vulnerable. And without these vaccines, babies would be less safe, less protected from nasty, potential fatal diseases. And that's why parents take their children along to the local GP to have them administered. Currently, from the age of 1 to 16 years old, 5 more vaccines may be administered to children until we get to older people who may be offered several other vaccines from the age of 65 years. There's even a shingles vaccine. And even when pregnant, women are offered a whooping cough vaccine. So vaccines are entwined, they are embedded into many, many aspects of our lives at various stages. And all of them are perfectly safe.
Well, she sounds very confident there, Martin. All vaccines are perfectly safe.
Yeah, well, I think this is the point is they were talking about the vaccine as if there's only one. the Pfizer vaccine, presumably, not the AstraZeneca one, not the Russian Sputnik vaccine, not the Cuban one,
the Chinese one,
etc. So, in other words, there's a bit of a confusion there. You've got
this is supposed to be a top level debate at Westminster Hall.
Right. Well, yes, I'm just trying to pick up on some of the issues there. So, in other words, talking about the vaccine, I mean, it's perfectly legitimate, and a lot of the vaccines she's talking about have been developed over many, many years and experimented on animals and all the rest of it. They didn't just rush them out in 8 months, as we were talking about earlier. So a lot of vaccines, I mean, maybe there are too many, maybe there's not enough, I don't know. But the point is, most of those vaccines have been developed under control conditions over many, many years. This vaccine has not. And as we pointed out, the Pfizer vaccine in particular is completely experimental. They've never used that technology before.
Well,
so they have no idea what the consequences are going to be.
There are actually only seven, because, I mean, they've said, well, it's very, very cold. We've got to keep it very cold. So they're only using seven centres around the country to be injecting the very elderly in care homes with this. I mean, they're not rolling out right across the country by any means. I don't know quite what's supposed to be going on down at Ashton Gate with the army, if they're still there.
Well,
I mean, maybe they've gone home.
Well, can I suggest that what's going on is a lot of propaganda about we're all right now and
I think they're waiting to see how are these people going to react, particularly the elderly and frail, that this hasn't been tested on yet. So it's kind of like a guinea pig live test.
It is. And the other thing that Steve Baker pointed out, I don't often agree with Steve Baker, but I think he was right about this. What they do not know is whether you can still transmit the virus even though you've been vaccinated. Now, if it's the case that you can still transmit the virus even though you've been vaccinated, then it's got a limited use, because these people then will go out into society thinking I'm okay, and they could be transmitting the virus to all sorts of different people and therefore in actual fact spreading it. So I would argue that the way you deal with this, and the way to deal with it, and we've been shown in Southeast Asia, you have to actually go for zero transmission of the virus, and then you can take your time about vaccines. And that's the only way.
Okay, so I think we're at a break now. As a way of by introduction, our last show we'll be back here in 3 weeks' time, folks, 2 weeks off. What is your copper's hunch, Martin? I know you're quite good at copper's hunches, and you're quite often right, actually, about what nationality is behind this virus.
Well, as we said earlier, it looks as if the most likely place where it started was in the United States of America. And I would argue that it's probably the deep state in the US working with their allies elsewhere, including here.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM, ITT, and ATP. The DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide.
specialist. Corporate opportunists and culture industry manipulators have failed you immensely. Failed you in that America's distrusted by the world powers and hated by the developing nations alike. Failed you in that we've left you with no vision of a world community and no education to develop such a sense. Consolidated, appealing to the people of Britain. Don't support the fascist war started by the U.S. against a poor third world country just to divert attention away from the war they conduct against their own people every single day. Our politicians and entertainers continue to lie to us repeatedly.
Don't believe the hype.
Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last of them tonight, obviously. America Number One is the title of it.
So, John Peel there, back announcing 1992, one of his Peel sessions, Consolidated, with their song America Number One, specially tailored. This is Consolidated appealing to the youth of Britain. Rather nicely put in there, and that was the sort of stuff that we used to get on the BBC, if you can believe that, back in the 1990s. That one I recorded, I think it must have been just recorded back in 1992. Martin, in a way, the song has got a very important message, and that is, there is no America, there is only IBM, ITT, AT&T, that actually it's the interests represented by the Council on Foreign Relations, these big financial interests that really run the show. And I think we've probably seen that, haven't we, in this recent election with so-called democracy, with Biden supposedly taking over to now represent the people for another 4 years.
Well, you know, that's a rhetorical point, and I largely agree with it. But of course, in actual fact, the state is enmeshed with the corporate sector and vice versa. So, you know, the idea that it's just the corporate sector or just the government is wrong. I mean,
it's pretty simple if you've only got two main parties. It's pretty simple to make sure that the corporations have got a foot in both camps, and that they're basically giving people a choice between Tweedledum and Tweedledee, who both of whom they control. And we've seen that, I think, with Starmer over here too, that it doesn't really make a lot of difference except Brexit, who people were to vote for, Labour or Conservative, last December.
Well, I think what the US and Britain are particularly open to manipulation because of the electoral system. In other systems which are more open, for example, Germany, I'm not saying that it's brilliant in Germany, but you've certainly got a far wider legitimate spread of political opinion, or Russia, because they don't have a first-past-the-post system. And what you've got, if you get first-past-the-post, is that you've just got two teams to control, whereas if you haven't, it's more difficult for the corporate sector to dominate the agenda.
But you don't think that the whole COVID agenda across the world, really basically foisted on us by the World Health Organization, who are the UN's health arm, mainly funded by Bill Gates now, and the World Health Organization have a program that we also, didn't we have this week, we had Tetros, I can't remember his second name. He's the boss of the World Health Organization, indicted for war crimes in Ethiopia from a few years ago. So this isn't exactly a squeaky clean organization when you've got the boss of it being indicted for war crimes.
Well, the World Health Organization, like the UN and the UN system of which it's a part, is a spatchcock of various countries' political systems.
Or companies, or the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, I mean, it's extraordinary.
The pharmaceutical industry dominate it, surely.
Yes, they do. And in actual fact, the World Health Organization, as originally conceived, is supposed to be an intergovernmental organization. And when Trump resigned from the World Health Organization, the biggest funder of the World Health Organization became Bill Gates, bigger than the Chinese, who were also big funders of it.
I mean, this is the way I think that the international system that was set up after the Second World War to keep us all safe is being disgustingly eroded, and that is by money coming into the UN and its various institutions in order to basically private. It's what's going on is the international global regulators, the UN, is being privatised.
Listen, the system wasn't set up after the Second World War to keep us safe. The Bretton Woods system, the IMF, the World Bank, and what was the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trades, which became the WTO, was set up to basically dominate the planet on behalf of the West.
Oh, no, 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 hang on a minute.
That's what the whole idea
of the UN was to try and make sure that another aggressive Second World War style thing with the Germans getting as powerful as they did and working with the Japanese couldn't happen again. That was the point of the Security Council and the Articles of the Association of the United Nations and Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That was all set there by people who'd lived through World War II to try and make sure it didn't happen again. It's all being privatised now, is my point.
Well, the aspirations behind it are there. And of course, it's never actually been able to fulfil its function as a public service structure because of all of the. I mean, don't forget
until 1961 and the murder of Dag Hammarskjöld. Surely, it was pretty much doing its job. The Secretary General of the United Nations, when there was a conflict around the world, obviously it didn't manage to do it in Korea and later in Vietnam. But when there was a small conflict in a small African country, the UN Secretary General would go in there and get it sorted.
Yes, except that he was assassinated and it wasn't sorted, and Mobutu Sese Seko took over in Zaire, supported by MI6 and the Americans, and killed millions of his own people whilst putting all his money in Switzerland. Now, what the reality is the world is built on power. Those who have the power are the ones who decide what happens, and those who don't are the ones who have to suck it up.
Anyway, so
as ever thus.
I reckon it's interesting to take a look back at what was going on at the beginning of the Second World War, 1939, when Neville Chamberlain came on the BBC Home Service and announced that there was a war, that Britain has declared war on Germany, which we did. They didn't declare war on us. We declared war on them because of the invasion of Poland. So let's go back now to 1939. How many years is that now? Must be 80 and a bit years, mustn't it? And listen to the announcement that Neville Chamberlain made on the radio. I have edited this down a little bit, but it contains, I think, what I thought was absolutely fascinating, which were the measures that he also announced when he announced that war had been declared.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany. You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful. At such a moment as this, the assurances of support which we have received from the Empire are a source of profound encouragement to us. When I have finished speaking, Certain detailed announcements will be made on behalf of the government. Give these your close attention. The government have made plans under which it will be possible to carry on the work of the nation in the days of stress and strain that may be ahead. But these plans need your help. You may be taking your part in the fighting services or as a volunteer in one of the branches of civil defense. If so, you will report for duty in accordance with the instructions you receive. You may be engaged in work essential to the prosecution of war or the maintenance of the life of the people, in factories, in transport, in public utility concerns, or in the supply of other necessaries of life. If so, it is of vital importance that you should carry on with your jobs. Now, may God bless you all, and may He defend the right. For it is evil things that we shall be fighting against. Brute force, bad faith, injustice, oppression, and persecution. And against them, I am certain that the right will prevail.
That is the end of the Prime Minister's statement. Please stand by for the important government announcements, which, as the Prime Minister has said, will follow almost immediately.
This is London. The government have given instructions for the following important announcements. Closing of places of entertainment. All cinemas, theatres, and other places of entertainment are to be closed immediately until further notice. In the light of experience, it may be possible to allow the reopening of such places in some areas. They are being closed because if they were hit by a bomb, large numbers would be killed or injured. Sports gatherings and all gatherings for purposes of entertainment and amusement, whether outdoor or indoor, which involve large numbers congregating together, are prohibited until further notice. This refers especially to gatherings for purposes of entertainment. But people are earnestly requested not to crowd together unnecessarily in any circumstances. Churches and other places of public worship will not be closed.
Well, a few interesting similarities, a few interesting differences there. Churches remaining open, but lots and lots of closure. I mean, the thing is, we don't have a world war just starting. We have a kind of slow burn, pre-World War III thing going on with all sorts of other invasions. We've got terrorist attacks occasionally, this sort of thing. But what we've got, Martin, now is the conditions that we did have at the beginning of the Second World War, the same sort of thing. No gatherings, and no entertainment.
Well, they're not entirely the same situation, are they?
Well, that's the point I'm trying to make, though. We've got a war situation without a war.
Well, it may be if it's a biowarfare attack, as we've been arguing, that the war's already started. But of course, if it's...
Would they just simply not want to tell the population if something like that was going
on?
Well,
no, but don't forget, if they've done it, and we suspect they have, then of course the war's already begun and the Chinese are treating it as if they're... Don't forget, we were talking about the fishing issue earlier, but in actual fact, the Queen Elizabeth is in the South China Sea as we speak, trying to protect our sovereignty from the Chinese
Navy.
Yeah,
China is absolutely key in a lot of this, and I did mention briefly MH370 earlier. Looking into that, there's a terrific article, the Daily Express article, very important, I think. I mean, it may have been reported elsewhere, but it's, so far as I can see, it's the only UK paper to report it, that there were these 20 people on the Malaysian Airlines H370 flight working for a company called Freescale Semiconductor. They had developed some kind of electronic warfare system. And obviously they got money from a hedge funds or whatever to do that. They developed the system, Martin. And then they went along to the US military and said, well, we've got this wonderful new electronic warfare system. The US military doesn't work in a totally fair fashion, though, does it? Because you've got a lot of vested interests. So you've got massive companies, not like this little piddling Freescale Semiconductor, that get most of the contracts. And they wouldn't be happy about some new kids on the block turning up and saying, well, we want some defense contracts, please.
Well, I mean, that's an allegation in relation to the downing of the airliner.
I'm not really talking about that. What I'm talking about is the... you're just being so evasive. What I'm talking about here is just the idea that the American military's contracts are basically stitched up. Much of the material that they get is from long-term contractors, dodgy deals being done with the military, and in the end of the day, the soldiers get really awful equipment because of the contract fraud going on.
Well, it's not just contract fraud. I mean, you mentioned Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth there. And what we've got there, and it took years, as you know, is we've got peer-reviewed scientific articles concerning the collapse of Building 7, WTC 7, University of Alaska.
But what's this got to do with what I was saying?
I'm just pointing out that it's not just that the contracts are being ripped off. We know that. It's an actual fact that they're engaged in terrorism and killing large numbers of people so they can start wars to kill millions more.
So what I'm trying to do here is explain that what you've got is you've got a massive story like this. An airliner disappears. First of all, we're expected to believe that it's disappeared in the South China Sea. Then there's more radar traces released, and then we can see that actually the what we've seen so far was just the first radar trace, and actually flew back over Malaysia into the Indian Ocean, and then started doing these zigzag patterns. It looks as if Rolls-Royce also then announced to the public that the engines have been switched off normally at a time from its original destination, which would put it possibly in the Maldives or around Diego Garcia, which is an enormous United States air base, which is the Chagos Islands, which was stolen from the people of the Chagos Islands by the British and then handed over to the Americans, Diego Garcia, that is. The actual background to this is what you've got is you've got some people developing a new military bit of kit. They go to the United States Pentagon and people like that, and then they say, hey guys, we've got this wonderful thing. And they go, well, sorry, we're not having this. And they're shut out of the US military market by the monopolistic practices that you've got over there. And so they get on a plane to fly over to China. And they think to themselves, well, maybe we can sell this to the Chinese. So there you've got a very, very strong, very plausible motive why Freescale Semiconductors, 20 top staff sitting on a Malaysian airliner, could have been downed and the whole thing covered up by the military, by our own military, killing our own people.
Yes, just like 9/11. And of course, these people, if they were going to China, you could possibly argue that they could feel justified in doing it. But of course, 9/11 is actually killing random people in order to. And of course, we've got lots of evidence about that, because and scientific evidence as well, that nanothermite was definitely used in the explosives, because Nils Harrit and Steve Jones, who were both chemists, had it reviewed in the chemistry journals, and they showed that nanothermite was found in the dust from the
Tony Paul. Tony Paul's book, and I think he works for Computer Weekly now. I did try and interview him about it. He didn't want to talk about the book, but he shows something like 40 British electronics experts in the military field who died of various suspicious accidents and suicide, mainly in the 1980s. So it looks as if people who were working for the Freescale Semiconductor were along this category of experts in some sort of new military technology that was simply bumped off by the West, in the West.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, if you work on military technology, you've got to recognise that you're going to be a target.
You're a military target.
Yeah,
and not
you are.
Necessarily by the other side. That's the incredible thing.
No, of course not. I mean, most people are killed by their own side in most wars.
Anyway, I'll put a link up to that fascinating article from The Express about MH370. It's MH370's shock. Missing plane could have been hijacked by terrorists targeting US engineers. Well, actually, it wasn't targeted by hijackers. But the information is in the article about Freescale Semiconductor being on board. It almost certainly have been either hacked and remotely controlled, or else the pilot just told by the military, fly this way, fly that way. The zigzag patterns, though, Martin, are very reminiscent of 9/11, aren't they?
The idea is
that once you leave a radar screen area, that nobody knows where you're heading next, because all they can see is you're zigzagging, or they can't plot your course to where your final destination would be.
Yes, and you can't do that by flying on instruments, because you're too high up. So, in other words, it's global hawk technology.
It's certainly likely to have been hacked.
Yeah, it's hacked.
Just looking at news roundup from antiwar.com now, senators are likening a hack to a Russian invasion. Oh, dear, here we go. The Russians again. The Russians are in. I mean, this is one of the things we keep hearing about Biden, is Martin. He's going to be really ramping up the Russian threat everywhere, as if the Russians are responsible for everything.
Yeah, well, the only competition between Biden and Trump ultimately is who we're going to go to war with first. Trump's saying China, Biden's saying Russia. And, of course, the Russians and the Chinese are... I mean, Putin this week has recognised Biden because of the Electoral College vote. He's finally said, congratulations to you, Mr. Biden. But, of course, he was holding back to see what was going to happen. Well, the Chinese recognised Biden some while ago. And, of course, you know, basically both Trump and Biden, despite all the massively partisan things that are going on in the US political system, they are both absolutely creatures of the military industrial complex.
But they're saying that the Russians have hacked the American government, and all these American government agencies' websites have been hacked, their email systems have been hacked, their computers have been hacked, Moscow's attacking them.
Well, let's put it this way. I don't believe a word they say.
This is virtually a declaration of war by Russia that we should take seriously, said Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat, Illinois. Well, so he's a Bidenite.
Yes. And when we've got a British Army general yesterday going on about how the Russians are coming, they're trying to destroy us in all sorts of different ways. So you've got to, you know, there's a general propaganda against the Russians and the Chinese. And then, on top of that, you've got the actual fact of what's actually... Let's put it this way. We allow ourselves, GCHQ, is in a position to hack Russian systems, and they were saying at one stage, perhaps what we need to do is cause train wrecks on the Moscow underground. They came out and said that as our way of getting back at them for hacking our stuff. Now, in actual fact, in warfare, both sides are allowed to hack each other's computers. And if you can't protect your own computers, that's your lookout. That's warfare.
Iran's president expects the United States will return to the nuclear deal. Iran will quickly come into compliance with the JCPOA if the other signatories uphold their end of the deal, he says. Now, that's one piece of good news, isn't it? I mean, hopefully. Do you think the Americans will lift sanctions? What the Iranians are saying is, look, guys, if you're up for redoing the deal, we'll get back in compliance pronto.
I don't think they will. I think Biden basically has been warned off from trying to do anything like that. And don't forget the Trump faction in the US are quite strong. They're going to be breathing down his neck. And the Israelis are definitely opposed to that. If they thought that Biden was going to go back into the nuclear deal, it's quite likely that they would cause some kind of incident, like the assassination of the scientists that we saw a couple of weeks ago, in order to try and sabotage it. And I don't think Biden doesn't strike me as the sort of Democrat president who's going to turn around and tell the warmongers where they can stick
it. Thank you.
Absolutely not.
Thanks for reminding me about that assassination, Martin. Terrible things I forget. But we did talk about that a bit last week, the reprisal that happened just the day before we were on air last week. It looks like against an Israeli Mossad officer in the middle of Tel Aviv. An incredible thing about that attack is that there are actually quite a lot of pictures of it around in the Lebanese press, in various other Middle Eastern newspapers, but most importantly, it was very much highlighted all over the Turkish press. So in the Turkish newspapers and on Turkish television, they announced there'd been a counter assassination of a Mossad agent in Tel Aviv less than a week after the top nuclear scientist was killed.
Yeah, and it just shows that people exist within different media bubbles, don't they?
Do you read Turkish?
No.
That's the whole point, isn't it? The Turkish people know that something's happened, but people in the West are just not allowed to know. Well, I mean, it sounds as if they're being... Whoever's done that assassination, the Western media are complicit.
No, well, what's happened there... I mean, I picked it up, as you know, from New Eastern Outlook, which is the Russian Academy of Sciences that in English, that's
banned by you. Actually, no, banned by Facebook. Yeah. You try and post anything from there on Facebook, it comes back and tells yeah. you, "Oh, this is all fake news on this website." Okay. We don't allow.
Well, basically, a lot of the people who write for it are academics in Russia who are experts on international affairs. And of course, what they picked up, and in Israel itself, it was reported, but not much was made of it. And of course, in the Western,
I'm not sure it was reported in Israel. I didn't find it in any of the Israeli press.
Yeah, well, the point is that the Israelis do not want to flag up if their guy has been killed in that way.
There was a very they heavy don't want police to flag presence. It up. Whatever had happened, there was a car on the street. There's pictures of it in the Turkish yeah. press. There was a car on the street with bullet holes all down it, and there was about 10 or 12 what looked like, you know, incident unit and police vehicles last Thursday night in Tel Aviv. Something had happened. And in fact, the report that said that this wasn't a Mossad officer, someone had obviously thought, oh, we've got to say this wasn't a Mossad officer. It didn't say who it was. It just said, oh, it was...
Well,
they
did give a name.
What they said was a person of no consequence. They didn't even make up a name of somebody that it
well,
wasn't.
Well, in the article I read, they gave the name.
No, they gave the name of the person that it was in the Turkish press, etc. But they didn't say in the other article, no, this was just a person of no consequence who was killed.
Yeah, well, you can imagine from the Israeli point of view and their kind of media management strategy, they do not want to admit that this guy's been assassinated, especially if he's somebody high up, because it then begs the question about what's going on. And of course, the Iranians will not fess up and say they did it either. You know, back in the days when the provisional IRA campaign was in full swing, the IRA used to issue statements through P. O'Neill in Dublin, and they would take credit for various or discredit, in the case of the Birmingham bombs, for example, by giving press releases. But that's one way of doing things. The other way of doing things is you just top people on the other side, but you don't take the credit. They get the message. It's quite and what they're showing is that we can operate in Tel Aviv and we can assassinate your top people just as you can come into Iran and assassinate our top people.
I don't think it's
people.
Possible to say for sure whether it happened or not, but certainly all the Turkish media was reporting it. Israeli Mossad technical officer Fahmi Henavi is reported assassinated in Tel Aviv on Thursday, the 3rd of December, 2020, in retaliation for Iranian nuclear scientist Muhsin Farizad.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds plausible to me. Of course, all of these things have to be checked, double-checked, because it's a wilderness of mirrors.
If anyone wants to look for it, it's Fahmi Henavi. That is Fahmi Hinavi. But they couldn't give a name for the person who was supposed to be of no consequence, who was actually killed in that incident with all the police.
Well, if they're of no consequence, who's murdered them and why?
I just think it's a very patronising way to talk about somebody. Here's somebody of no consequence. Don't worry, it's nothing to do
with
the Mossad.
What they're doing is they're trying to say it's just some random thing. It was he'd been having sex with somebody else's wife. And that's a tactic,
this does make sense for the Iranians. If one of their people is assassinated, they're going to track down someone directly involved and assassinate them back in return. And that, I suppose the Iranians don't even mind if it's not covered in the press in the West. The main thing is that the people who are in the know will know.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, after the assassination of Soleimani, there was a senior US guy who was in the CIA. I think I've forgotten the name. You can't remember all the names. But he was involved in a crash in Afghanistan. And of course,
he was the CIA's Iran expert. Or yes, the main guy.
Yeah, but he ended up being involved in a crash in Afghanistan. Supposedly in a light plane, but of course, and the Iranians may have
it was a business jet.
But I mean, the Iranians may have had a hand in assassinating him. But of course, if you're going to carry out assassinations like that, I mean, the Soleimani assassination was a bit different because Trump boasted, "Yes, we did this, and it was done with missiles."
Well,
from
of course,
a,
what happens
from
is
a, from
when
a, from
we
a helicopter
when the West assassinates an Iranian, it's all over the press. When the other thing happens the other way around, it's not in the press. But this is a very, I mean, I suppose the ultimate question here, Martin, is if the Iranians don't assassinate somebody back, we could be heading down to an enormous rabbit hole there where anybody in the Iranian government could be assassinated at the drop of a hat.
Well, that's always been true. And of course, what deters the other side?
They're going to have to think twice about this sort of thing.
Well, that's why people retaliate, isn't it? I mean, you know, you can, you know, ultimately, One of the things that makes these people so reckless is the feeling that they are invulnerable and that nobody can get to them. And if you can show that you can get to them, then of course it does have a deterrent effect.
Well, let's just hope that they've digested that maybe there are consequences to assassinating Iranians and think twice about the next time. Anyway, so I thought we'd have a look at something, whatever it is that's going on with the Great Reset. This is a sort of continuing mystery, really, particularly when we've got Prince Charles down the road here in Tetbury, one of the main leaders, apparently, of it around the world. As I said last week, it certainly looks as if he will be going off to do some sort of global role next April when the Queen retires, as she said she'll do, when she reaches 95. Prince Philip retired also when he was 95. And then Prince Charles will actually get a lot of cachet if he does say, oh, actually, I don't want the throne. Let's let William have it. A very good thing to do, and everyone will start liking Prince Charles again, because he's sort of, the questions about his involvement with Diana and the way he treated her have meant that he's not really that popular in the UK. So I spoke early this week to someone about the World Economic Forum who wrote what I thought was an excellent article in Conservative Woman about the technocracy, the coming technocracy, and I'll put a link up to that on our show page. Her name is Lucy, and here she is talking about the World Economic Forum's link to the whole climate agenda.
If you think that 9/11, for example, was not exactly what they tried to say it was, that was the beginning of a war on terror, but it didn't really frighten people quite enough. They then tried the climate change thing, the war on carbon. That didn't produce any bodies. So having a virus, a man-made bioweapon virus, whether it was deliberately released in terms of timing or not, is not obvious. That actually produced some bodies, and that's what absolutely terrified everybody. So that was a far more successful strategy, because when you have people terrified, you can manipulate society in so many different ways.
Okay, hang on, because you just brought the climate in there. Now, there is some talk about the climate somehow being involved with the Great Reset, some sort of environmental thing. So, yeah, so ask you again, whereabouts do you think we're going with this? It does look as if there's going to be an attempt anyway to change somehow the world's financial system, and many people have been throwing their hands up over the last decades saying it's not working, and they're pretty much right, aren't they? The IMF, the World Bank, the global financial system has kind of hit the buffers, really.
Well, the thing is that they are using carbon as an excuse to completely change the way we live, and to tax us, and to basically monitor our use of carbon. But nobody can really be totally 100% certain that it's going to make any difference to climate. So again, it's another thing that can be used as an excuse for controlling us. And so climate is. That has already always been their main agenda. So the thinking is that the UN wasn't getting on with the job quickly enough, which is why the World Economic Forum stepped in and they signed a strategic partnership in June of last year, in 2019, in order to push the sustainable development goals harder, because they weren't getting anywhere just leaving it to the UN. It was too bureaucratic. So that's why the World Economic Forum stepped into the gap.
Lucy Wyatt there speaking to me yesterday about this. Martin, interesting idea, this whole idea of carbon being used, your effect on the carbon is going to determine, what you are and aren't allowed to do in future.
Well, you've got to distinguish between what you might call legitimate concerns about carbon footprints from the manipulations of an elite body like the World Economic Forum. And I remember when this was first coming to fruition years ago, when I worked for the New Economics Foundation, and it's interesting that the control of carbon emissions has become the central issue for environmentalists, when in actual fact, as we heard earlier, the thing that's killing people most in the developing world is not having enough to eat. And of course, if we were to really transform the global society, we'd probably have to have massive land reform, which would involve probably civil wars in places like Nicaragua. And they've had civil wars in order to try and change the structure of land ownership.
Well, Lucy's
that is nothing to do with eating less burgers and not driving and driving electric cars.
Well, I was just fascinated.
It's a fight to the finish between the haves and the have-nots.
By Lucy's article, it's technocracy and the abolition of man. It's really looking at where all this could be heading. So I thought obvious to ask her about that, and also about Trump. What is his role? Is he? She seemed to think, Martin, actually, before we hear from her, maybe I'll ask you this. She seemed to think there is an outside chance that he might actually be president, because much of many of the court cases still haven't even been heard yet.
Well, if we're going to talk about what's going on with that, the court cases have largely thrown out what he's doing. The Supreme Court, which of course he packed, refused to even consider the stuff being put forward by Texas and the other, what were basically the Confederacy states plus some Midwestern states. And of course, what's actually happening is that the US is splitting into its component parts. And it may, you see, even if there was electoral fraud, it still doesn't mean that Trump won the most votes. The electoral system in the US allows people who've got less votes. Trump last time got 3 million less votes than Hillary Clinton, but the electoral college system allowed him to be president.
At the end of all of this, people are going to be saying, well, actually, the democratic system doesn't work, aren't they? And they'll be saying, oh, can someone else come along and run this?
Well, Flynn, who was the general that was close to Trump, and then was arraigned because he was at an RT gig next to Putin in Moscow, he's calling for the army to rerun the election in the various states, which they're claiming that the thing was stopped. So in other words, we're moving to a situation, whoever ends up in the White House on January the 20th, the other side aren't going to accept it, and they're calling for the army to intervene. And this is a nuclear power, folks, with more nuclear weapons than the rest of the planet combined.
Anyway, let's finish our... I'll put a link up on our show page to the full interview with Lucy White, what she has to say about Trump and the end objectives of the plandemic.
With the Great Reset, the World Economic Forum, the globalists are really going for broke. Do you think there'll be any sort of centres for resistance against that?
Well, this is why my personal opinion so much hinges on Trump, because he is the one major global leader that is not on board with the World Economic Forum's whole setup. And then here in the UK, it's possible that Nigel Farage's new Reform Party, they also consider the World Economic Forum stuff to be appalling, but they're not being very open about that. It's not obvious where you can get information on that, but we know that Farage is very much in the Trump camp, and he is going to provide an alternative to both the Labour Party and the Conservatives. And then there's Lawrence Fox, but I don't know to what extent Lawrence Fox actually really understands these bigger issues.
Okay, so if the World Economic Forum do get their way, what kind of world are we going to be in 5 years' time?
Look at China. China is the roadmap. It's all facial recognition. It's all social credits. It's everything monitored, everything tracked and traced. And if you fall foul of the regime, who knows if you can even eat or whatever? You won't be able to travel. You won't be able to go anywhere. It'll be pretty grim, and it's pretty grim now. This is a really good test case with all these lockdowns and the fact that we're being told who we can see, where we can go, what we can do. It'll just be a continuation of that.
Lucy, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tony.
Okay, so that's Lucy White there. Her actual article is Technocracy and the Abolition of Man, looking at the World Economic Forum's vision for the future, Martin. She just calls it technocracy. The idea here really being that everything's going to be AI, and minimal amount of human beings involved in all decisions that running society.
Well, it's not technocracy. It's not technocracy that's the problem in my mind, Tony. It's international capitalism. And the idea that the Chinese are in on this is simply wrong. The Chinese are the main obstacle to what the
world is doing. I don't think she actually said that. She said that there are people in the West who want to institute a China-like state with mass surveillance and a kind of dehumanized version of the West.
Yes, and there certainly is. But one of the problems they're going to have at a certain, as we go forward now, is that because the real economy is stuffed, ultimately the banking system is going to collapse. And the idea that they're going to control the consequences of that is simply wrong. The Chinese are actually forging ahead. Their banking system is much less vulnerable to collapse than the West banking system. And ultimately, there's going to be a collapse in the West. And the West is not going to rule the world anymore in the way that it's done in the last 500 years. And of course, for some people, that's going to be very, very hard to take.
So we'll wind up tonight with a couple of clips. One is from Dr. Vernon Coleman. He's talking about his experience of trying to go and just say a few words of prayer in a church and being booted out by some rather officious chap, and also a little bit more. But anyway, this is his kind of Dr. Vernon Coleman Christmas message. He's very much like me. He doesn't believe that the institution of the Church of England or any other specific church really means a lot. When it comes to actually a relationship with Christ and being a Christian, you don't have to be inside a specific church. And also that the other side has attempted over the years to take over the institution. I wonder if Vernon would agree with that. But anyway, here he relates his experience of trying to do a little prayer.
Since my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer, I've always gone into every church I've seen. I've said a prayer and lit a candle. It's become an important ritual for me. The other day I went into a large church, which I visited dozens of times. As I entered, a man came hurtling towards me, clearly a church employee. He wore plastic gloves and the inevitable mask, and he was waving his arms and shouting at me. "You can't come in," he said. "We're closing." I looked at my watch. It was just after 3 p.m. "Can I just stay for 2 minutes?" I begged. "I just want to pray and light a candle." "No," he said, rudely and rather aggressively. "You can come back tomorrow at 11 a.m. "But I won't be here then," I said, "and I'll be gone in 2 minutes. Just a candle and a short prayer." I realized with some slight embarrassment that tears were pouring down my cheeks. "No," he said, with all the compassion of a government minister or a vaccine salesman. "You have to leave." So I left. And I'll never go into a church again. I'll be what I've been all my life, an irreligious Christian. You don't have to go to church to be or behave like a Christian. Our religious leaders have betrayed us this year, and the disdain and contempt they have for us has clearly spread downwards. In my view, the Archbishop of Canterbury is a disgrace, a shell of a man, and I shall in future find my spiritual comfort elsewhere. It's not coincidental, of course. I'm not mad or paranoid, but I know enough to know that everything that's happening to us was planned meticulously. The world hasn't gone mad, and the politicians aren't behaving badly or stupidly. Everything that's happened since February 2020 has been deliberate. It's all been planned. I believe Ferguson was chosen to make the predictions because his past record at predicting is appalling. In my view, he's 1% scientist and 99% buffoon. I believe that Hancock was made Minister of Life and Death because he's a halfwit whose blathering incompetence creates confusion, bewilderment and fear. I believe that Whitty and Valance got to destroy our lives in the UK because they both have links to powers that want to destroy every aspect of our world. Whitty once worked for Gates's money, and Valance once worked for a major vaccine manufacturer. Much the same has, I believe, occurred elsewhere in the world. I wouldn't trust Fauci, the American supremo, to syringe my ears or clip my toenails. More lies have been told about COVID-19 than have ever been told about anything, ever before. These haven't been small mistakes. They've been huge, monumental lies. Everything they've said and predicted has been wrong. No one could be as stupid as our politicians and their advisers appear to be. Just why doctors, nurses and journalists believe this nonsense is a mystery. anyone in those professions who doesn't realise that this is a scam shouldn't be employed. I'm not being pushy, but if governments were honest, they'd fire all their advisers and hire me. My predictions for what would happen during 2020 have been absolutely accurate since the beginning of the year, and my forecasts are all online for anyone to check. I'd advise the government for a peppercorn one penny a year, but I don't want the job, and they won't hire me, of course. They want advisers who get everything wrong. Temporary measures, as introduced by governments, are never temporary. They become permanent. And so, in our case, the lockdowns, the social distancing, the masks, and the hand sanitizers will remain to remind us that we're in danger and should therefore be fearful. The hypoxia caused by the masks will, of course, make people ever more stupid and accepting, thereby conditioning them and preparing them to accept future tyrannies.
Well, for me, the superstar, the hero of 2020, that's Vernon Coleman. Martin, you're not so keen on Vernon, no? Or what? What do you make of it? Because he managed to inject some humour into this, which is actually quite a difficult thing to do. And, of course, he's a medical doctor. He was very popular in the press up until this all started to happen. Even last year, he was doing stuff in some of the newspapers. Now he's completely taboo. You're not allowed to hear him. And if you put anything by Vernon Coleman up on YouTube, it's immediately banned.
Yes, and you're a big fan, and I'm not. And I'm not because I don't think his analysis is correct, basically. He mentions Ferguson, he mentions Patrick Whitty and Valance. That's all very UK-based. In China, there is no lockdown because they did everything right in the beginning. It's a biological warfare attack.
Well, he didn't mention biological warfare there at all, did he? No biological warfare in his analysis. Why don't you go to China?
Why don't you go to Saudi Arabia? They're your allies.
No, they're not.
Oh, right.
They're not. I've never, ever gone on about how wonderful the Saudis are.
I'd go to New Zealand, but that's where you've been earlier in the year, Tony, because they've got it right as well.
Well, okay, maybe New Zealand. But,
and they've got no lockdown
China,
either.
I mean, you know, you've got a million people in re-education camps in China.
Yes, there's a hell of a lot of people in China. And, of course, in
Yemen... Oh, so they just happen to be in re-education camps.
And there are Uyghur terrorists.
And they're not terrorists. They're just Muslims. No, they're not terrorists,
Martin. Uyghur terrorists this is a NATO, in Syria.
This is a NATO thing where you just brand all Muslims as terrorists.
No.
The reason the Chinese government don't like Muslims...
This is a Russian military thing, Tony.
The reason the Chinese government don't like Muslims is because they don't believe that President Xi is God.
There is something called the Free East Turkestan Movement, which is actually based in Washington, D.C. It's funded by the CIA, and inside what is called East Turkestan by these people, what's called Xinjiang Province in China, they've been carrying out quite a few terrorist attacks, which have killed hundreds of people over the last years.
Why is it that any Muslim in China that doesn't believe that President Xi is God needs re-educating?
That's not the case, Tony. We're talking about particular political forces operating inside what they call East Turkestan. And there are several thousand Uyghurs inside the Idlib pocket.
Uyghurs.
Inside the Idlib pocket in Syria. They're not from Syria, but they've been sent there via Turkey, and they're funded by NATO, by our taxes, British taxes. And they've killed lots of Syrians, but the Syrian Arab army, have got them into the Idlib pocket.
And you think it's okay for the Chinese government to lock people up for laughing at the national anthem?
No, and I don't think it's fair that we should be turning Yemen into the worst.
So we're talking about China here.
Now the situation.
You're painting China as some sort of wonderful place.
No, China is a work in progress. If you were in China in the 1960s, you would see that it's completely transformed.
Well,
It's an authoritarian work in progress. Yes. And of course, ultimately, they are basically the opposition to the World Economic Forum and the domination of the developing world by the Western powers.
I mean, President Xi's now a dictator, isn't he?
No, he's not. He's answerable to the Chinese Communist.
He's never been elected.
No, he's been elected by the Chinese Communist Party, who are a minority. Yeah. Yeah? They've got a one-party system in China. They've got a two-party system in the US, but there's no democracy in the US.
So he's a dictator then. You've just said it.
Well, whoever's running the United States.
If they've got a two-party system in the US, which isn't a lot better, but having a one-party state, you can't say that the person who's running that for life is not a dictator. Of course he is.
All right. So You are with Pompeo here. We're going
I didn't say that.
Now,
you see, this is where you and I are very different, Martin. I'm quite prepared to condemn both.
I'm prepared to criticise China, but you've got to recognise that if you want to get rid of the Chinese Communist Party rule in China, you're saying let's go to war with China.
No, I don't.
Well, if you're going to do that, we've actually sent our aircraft carrier to the South China Sea now, and if they sink it and kill thousands of our sailors, then we will be going to war with China.
But that's not my aircraft carrier.
Aircraft carrier because you've paid for it.
No, Martin. That's someone else's aircraft carrier. It's your aircraft carrier too. But the fact of the matter is that China is an absolutely appalling authoritarian state, and it doesn't allow the sort of things that we're saying here, which we can say only just because we're being closed down by the Bristol Community Radio people. In China, it's a crime to say this. You just get arrested for it.
In Saudi Arabia, they just chop your head off. But they're our allies, and we spend we actually get a lot of money from them, and that's something we can actually do something about. And of course, in China, the Chinese Communist Party came to power because the British in the 1840s flooded the country with opium and destroyed the existing political structure.
They came to power in the Second World War.
Yes, because the Japanese were also our allies, invaded China. Yes, but China over the last...
The Japanese weren't our allies?
No, the Japanese are our allies today. But they were responsible for the invasion of China, which led directly to the Chinese Communist Party's seizure of power in China. The same thing happened in the First World War when the Germans allowed Lenin back to Russia to overthrow the Russian system. What we've got is, if you look in the big scheme of things, is you've got, say, 500 years ago, the Chinese were the most developed state on the planet, without a shadow of a doubt. But they were smashed and taken down by Western imperialism.
They didn't have industry, did they?
They did. There's a big question in the historical literature, why didn't capitalism develop first in China? Because they developed all of they developed gunpowder, they developed compasses, all sorts of technology. There's a famous series of books, Science and Civilization in China by Joseph Needham. What Chinese people today feel is that their achievements are belittled by the West, and that their attempts to try and have a dialogue with the West are constantly frustrated. And that what they would say about the Uyghurs...
Well, I think Lucy Wyatt's right, that Britain is starting to mimic China, that all the totalitarian, oppressive things that they do, whereas, I mean, things like trying to close down the demonstrations, that sort of thing, that's exactly what's happened even in Hong Kong now. As soon as you get more than three people together, you're all arrested in Hong Kong. This is no way to go. We need to have civil society needs to be able to get together in public and make a fuss if the government's doing things wrong.
I'm perfectly willing to listen to critiques of what goes on in China. They're not perfect. On the other hand, when we have got a secret system of prisons all over the world, the so-called secret rendition, Guantanamo is just the visible expression of that, and where people are tortured to death.
They have secret prisons in China too.
Yes, they do. Now, in other words, they're no better than we are. So why are we criticising them rather than the Saudis and criticising ourselves?
We do criticise the Saudis every week on here, actually, the United States and ourselves.
Well, indeed, and if we end up...
got to be critical of anything that's wrong. It's that simple.
Okay, but if we go to war with China, they will carry out the same kind of measures that we will carry out to control the population and keep the war going, just as we did in World War One and World War II.
But surely war is mainly used as a threat rather than, you know...
No, Tony. The real possibility is that we're going to do this. It's not just a fix to keep the rich rich.
Well, we shall see. Anyway, we'll finish this week with David Livingstone. He's a Muslim scholar, and he participated in the Eschatology 2020, the Darjalic New World Order symposium that I took part in a couple of weeks ago as well. So I thought we'd round off by hearing his take on the end of the world, all sounding rather grim, but obviously the nice thing about the end of the world is it all ends up rather nicely for the forces of good triumphing over the forces of darkness. So let's see what David Livingstone, he's also the author of a book, fantastic book actually, called The Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, had to say, what he thought of the history of the occult, the hidden history that we haven't been taught in our schools.
Mainly what I have traced is the history of the occult. The world we live in now, basically, we live in a world where after centuries of operating underground, the first successes of the occult secret societies were two revolutions, and that's the American and French revolutions. when, you know, after being basically being persecuted and forced in the ground for centuries, they finally managed to achieve some degree of political power. And they've been expanding that power ever since. Here you see Frederick the Great. I explain who that is. Here you have the family of Hessen-Kessel. You have Prince Charles of Hessen-Kessel, and that's the family where the Rothschilds basically begin their financial careers. Prince Charles is also not only a member of the Illuminati, he's also the founder, he's also Grandmaster of the Asiatic Brethren. I won't go into detail about what they are. Then basically he marries into the Danish family, and his great-grandson is Christian IV of Denmark, who's known as Grandfather of Europe. And it's that family that Queen Elizabeth comes from through her through intermarriage with the descendants of George the Third. Whoops. And here you have this is the family of the Dukes of Orléans. They are basically the founders of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, and their descendant is Philippe Galité, who is the Illuminati and one of the instigators, leaders of the French Revolution. So this is the family that basically gives birth to the Rosicrucian movement. That the Rosicrucians are the ones who are involved in instigating the career of Sabbatier Zvi, who declared himself Messiah in 1666. And it's this movement, the Sabbatian movement. So basically, the Sabbatian movement is a formulation of the Kabbalah of Isaac Luria. And what's important about Isaac Luria is that what was new in his version of Kabbalah is that he prescribed that the end times is not something that you wait for, it's something that you have to actively create. So this is why they created the career of Sabbatai Zvi. And from then on, it is the Sabbatians who are they are the ones who create. First they create they create the Royal Society, and out of the Royal Society comes the Freemasons. And then out of the Freemasons, specifically, the Sabbatians are responsible for creating Scottish Rite Freemasonry. And as Tony said, the motto of Scottish Rite Freemasonry is Ordo Ab Cow. And what that means is that you, since the end times describe a chaos preceding the advent of the Messiah, then therefore it means that you need to create those, that chaos as the precondition. What seems to be happening is that there's a deliberate attempt, of pitting the Christian evangelicals against the Muslims. And what's interesting is that Jay Michelson, who's actually his PhD was on Sabbatai Zvi, he wrote an article in the Daily Beast a couple of years ago, and he identified exactly this problem. He says, indeed, as a student of millennialism for some time, it was shocking to see the congruence between the Islamic State's vision of the end times and that of evangelical Christianity. The large battle somewhere north to the northwest of Jerusalem, a final battle in Jerusalem, with the near defeat of the heroic believers of an Antichrist figure and then Jesus appearing from heaven to win the battle once and for all. So this seems to be how the evangelicals are being pitted against the Muslims. And of course, the evangelicals, they are Christian Zionists, influenced heavily by the Sabbatians, and their focus, of course, is the rebuilding of the Third Temple, which is supposed to happen Al-Aqsa, which, of course, is going to be, if it goes forward, is going to be a substantial disruption and an affront to the Islamic world, which will likely outbreak in some kind of global conflict. One of the most important exponents of this occult tradition and conspirators involved in this effort is Alexander Dugin. So Alexander Dugin, basically, he is playing the role of advancing the mirror image of the clash of civilizations, which was articulated by the neoconservatives. And the clash of civilizations, again, is basically another formulation of the Book of Revelation, a preparation for the end times. So if you understand how Alexander Dugin explains it here, he explains how the bringing about the end times actively is a task. He says the end times and the get the logical meaning of politics will not realize themselves on their own. We will wait for the times in vain. The end will never come if we wait for it, and it will never come if we do not. This is essential because history, time, and reality have special strategies to avoid judgment day, or rather, they have a special strategy for a revelatory maneuver that will create the impression that everyone has come to realization and an understanding. This is the huge arsenal of Heidegger's noch nicht and the eternal not yet. If the fourth political practice is not able to realize the end times, then it will be invalid. The end times should come, but it will come. It will not come by itself. This is a task. It is not a certainty. It is active metaphysics. It is a practice. And I'll finish there because that's right on time.
So that's the culmination there of David Livingstone's half-hour presentation on the end of the world. Fascinating as well. I think it's his basic thesis is that the Book of Revelation was written by the bad guys. I would say, I mean, he's getting very close to the truth, but I'd say the Book of Revelation is written by the good guys, written by a guy called Procurus, who was the assistant to the Apostle John, who had been exiled by the Romans out to the island of Patmos, and John dictated this vision that he saw to him. I think God wrote the Book of Revelation because he wanted to make sure that his people in the future knew what was happening, and knew, rather than were absolutely horrified and disgusted by this conflict that was taking over the world and despairing of it, that they would realize that actually the ultimate outcome was that you can't just give up, you've got to keep fighting. And so we're going to finish with a song after this, which I came across this week. It's an old song I know from a long time ago, by Dr. John, which sums up that kind of sentiment, really. So we are very much, David Livingstone and I very much have different views, but we very much respect each other and our perspective on the Book of Revelation, and certainly worth a look if you get a time. Dust off your Bible and have a little read through and see what's in there. I've also got a Revelation timeline on my Bilderberg.org website. You can have a look and see what I made of it all. The idea, really, I think, is just simply to make sure that God's people know what's going on, and that it's not just some sort of mincing machine we're being put into, that we need to stand up to all of this. Time to sign off now. Thanks to the guests. That's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, activist from Stand Up Bristol, Harley Ford, who was on the line from the railway station. Download our MP3s. You can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I've been shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You can also pick up my books at Bilderberg.org. You can either get a free version, which has got a watermark in it, but you can still read it okay, or you can actually even buy one, which is also linked from that Bilderberg.org website. I'm just wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. You can request this show's reinstatement on FM. Links to email BCFM chiefs are on the contact tab on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. We're having a fortnight off now. Unless anything big happens, we'll be back on one way or another at thisweek.org.uk. If something big happens, do please join us for our politics show live stream at 5 o'clock on Friday the 8th of January. God bless, have a lovely Christmas, and don't let the banksters get you down. We're the never win.
cause to drive real hard. Try hard to get you. Cause maybe I'll lose and maybe I'll win. If I stop to lose, I just start all over again. Yeah, yeah, you can't stop me now. Now I'm going to take you that
quit. I never win.
I'm gonna get you in the end. I'm gonna get that feeling.